Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And it's so interesting. I mean, when you talk about Clinton even, and when you mentioned it, I want to really start going back to the archives. Because I want to see where Clinton was in 1967, you know, down in Arkansas somewhere. I mean, you know, how enlightened. I mean, I'm, you know, and I think that one of my great mentors was Sam Lacy, the great Sam Lacy, sports writer. And one of his great things for me, he died when he was 100 years old. But I would, when I got old, I would call him about issues, particularly, and he'd say, no, no, the guys who are like now, these white guys who are taking these sort of liberal roles, that's not who he was in 1955. You know, that wasn't. Well, that's not the position he took in 1957. And people are chameleons. And so, and I think, Walter, you touched on, like, today we have all this outpouring of affection and love. And I always, it always happens when people are dead, you know. And I'm like, well, what would you think about him when he opposed, when he wasn't going to fight in the war? What was Bill Clinton saying in 1967? And you're right, now he's going to give the eulogy. And I guess we have to sort of honor the people's wishes and just sort of move on. But it's amazing.
Well, it's a reality to honor, but also we have to honor and respect what people want to do.
Yeah,
but at the same time, we're intelligent creatures, yeah, and we can make assessments and analysis about that behavior.
Right.
See, and that's probably part of the problem. You know, we don't want to look at the behavior and say that is what it is. Right. We want to romanticize this whole thing about Ali. He's the greatest, you know.
Right.
But when I lived with him, in my experience, he wasn't the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
Not by any stretch of the imagination, but to a few people. Most of the people, he was not considered. They had problems still calling him Cassius Clay.
That's right.
He had to resist that.
When did you see that change from people starting to glorify him, starting to give him this credit? Around what time did you see that change occur?
I'll comment on that. You know, black folks in America didn't start calling themselves black until John Kennedy called them black. So what we're doing, we're following the racist pattern. They dictate and they confiscate not only people but ideas, concepts, and beliefs.
You know, there are a couple things. I wrote a column in today's New York Times. In fact, it's online now. But the first line of it was that Muhammad Ali was not a gentrified black man. And for some reason, that phrase, I don't know why the phrase just kept coming to me, because I was trying to think of, well, what the hell are you going to say about this guy? That everything, because first, half the stuff I've seen written, I'm just like, you know, these people don't believe this bullshit.
No.
You know, I mean, you have people who weren't even born. Your boy's Ira. I mean, I guess I'm not supposed to mention his name on the thing, but you have people... You know, all of us, you see, people who weren't even born. So what the hell are y'all talking about? Well, you know, with all that. I said, you weren't even fucking born. What the hell are you? I mean, you're talking about shit you read, you know.
Or saw, because I, in defense to that, I mean, I wasn't born.
I'm sorry, Jamal.
You know, I wasn't born. I wasn't.
He's my co-host, so
yeah. Right. But I wasn't born, but I was raised on Muhammad Ali.
But you're also
black. I'm black. I was raised on Muhammad Ali. My father was like a race man, as you say.
Right.
And I've always, you know, just, you know, I've listened to tapes of Malcolm X, and those are the two guys, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, the two guys I wish I was around to hear and see in person. But they definitely played a huge part in my life and who I am, and I wasn't born. Obviously, there are all kinds of different angles to that.
But you're also not trying to get on here and act like you were there when you weren't.
I wasn't there.
And then take it to like, and this is what it means, and this is how you should act.
That's
what galls me. When you've got, and that's why I say, well, Ollie was not gentrified. You got this whole army of young white cats who are going to tell you more, and it's really the fault of a lot of us black who have taught our kids. They're going to tell you they know more about black folks than you do. And then take it a step further, and this is what you need to do. I absolutely refuse it. I this Ali thing has kind of acted as sort of a springboard for a lot of that, for people to kind of come up and talk, you know.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 9th, 2016. So I have been told. The audio clip you heard at the beginning from Bill Rudin, his weekly podcast, Brothers on Sports. That was Jamal Murphy, Walter Beach, Mr. Rudin. That was their discussion that they had right days after the passing of Muhammad Ali. And you heard both of the main people mentioned from the book that we are concluding this week, Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Blood Brothers, the co-authors, Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, both suspected racists. As I stated, this is our final segment. We're picking up at the beginning of chapter 17, and we will wrap things up this week. So if you want to have in mind concluding thoughts, overall takeaways, I know folks have picked out a lot of patterns in terms of how they think racism is being practiced. And I think that sound clip that you heard at the beginning, I was thinking of that the entire time that we were reading this book. I thought that was one of the best dissections of, I think, what a lot of listeners, what we have pointed out the entire time that we've been reading this book, how whites, they come in, they steal ideas, they revise history and reinterpret with a racist, white supremacist agenda, how we think about people, events, things that have happened historically. They are masterful at this sort of thing. And I said months ago when Muhammad Ali died that I thought they would go to work. Might even submit that the co-authors, Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, they may have had in mind that it might be good timing to do this book as Muhammad Ali aging, his health had been declining, that he would probably pass away sometime soon. And this would be one of the more recent publications that people would turn to review his life and times. But without further ado, we will get started. This is the final study session on Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 1.
Chapter 17. Worthy of Death. The price of freedom is death. Malcolm X. Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad foretold, would not survive Allah's wrath. In his Muhammad Speaks column, he warned his former minister, "Allah is sufficient as a helper. You will not be able to help yourself pretty soon." His acolytes interpreted these prophetic words as a directive. For months, since the spring of 1964, vicious men, some with criminal records, seethed, daring Malcolm to return from Africa. Condemning Malcolm as a gutless coward, his former protege Louis X called him an international hobo, too scared to face the music. During Malcolm's time abroad, the nation's avengers threatened retribution if he ever set foot in America again. At the Richmond, Virginia mosque, Minister Nicholas condemned him. "Malcolm X really should be killed for teaching against Elijah Muhammad." Inside the pages of Muhammad Speaks, NOI officials published a series of cryptic articles predicting Malcolm's death. In a 5-page harangue, Lewis pilloried his old mentor, denouncing him as a heretic. The Boston minister also praised Muhammad Ali for resisting Malcolm's advances. True believers like Ali would never fall for Malcolm's deceptions. "Only those who wish to be led to hell or to their doom will follow Malcolm," he wrote. "The die is set, and Malcolm shall not escape, especially after such evil, foolish talk about his benefactor. Such a man as Malcolm is worthy of death. Although there is no evidence that Elijah Muhammad sent his disciples a direct order to assassinate Malcolm, in this climate, no such command was necessary. The vengeful language espoused at Muslim meetings and in the pages of Muhammad Speaks conveyed a clear mandate. Allah's messenger blessed those who struck back against the most dangerous hypocrites. The rhetoric espoused by Chicago officials contaminated the entire nation. Muhammad Ali was convinced by their claims that Malcolm fabricated vicious lies about Elijah's infidelities. And no man, Ali declared, could slander the messenger and get away with it. Malcolm X, and anybody else who attacks or talks about attacking Elijah Muhammad, will die. Captain Clarence could smell a rat. He was not certain, but he suspected that Leon Amir, Ali's press secretary, had been talking to Malcolm, divulging the nation's secrets, and maybe even Clarence's plot to kill the despised minister. Amir knew that any Muslim who talked to Malcolm risked his life. He had heard the messenger say so himself. According to Amir, in September, Muhammad called a secret meeting, ordering about 200 men from the Fruit to report to Chicago. For hours, Muhammad berated the sect's defectors. "Anyone who left the nation should be treated as a hypocrite," he announced. "And all hypocrites should be taken care of, either by beatings or killings, but it must be done carefully, when there were no witnesses." As for Malcolm, the greatest hypocrite, Muhammad demanded that the Fruit stop him at all costs. Amir was convinced that the Fruit would go to any length to fulfill the messenger's order. Shaken, he left the meeting certain that Malcolm was as good as dead. Since late August, when Clarence approached him about locating a silencer, he'd begun thinking about how he might leave the nation. He would need protection, but not even Malcolm could offer that. Malcolm could hardly protect himself. In October, while Ali trained in Boston, the heavyweight champion complained to Amir that the Muslims required numerous donations. Usually, members paid monthly dues to their local mosque. In his case, he would have donated to the Miami mosque, but the nation's officials demanded that he send all contributions directly to Chicago. No one knows exactly how much money Ali funneled to the nation's headquarters, but it was enough to make him grumble about it to Amir. Listening to Ali's complaints, Amir thought that he might be able to persuade him to quit the nation. The boxer was foolish for letting the black Muslims exploit him, he said. And someday the Muslims would jettison him when he was no longer valuable to Muhammad. Yet Amir's arguments failed to convince Ali. Malcolm had already told him the same thing, after all. "He's just a boy," Malcolm later said. "He doesn't know what he's doing. He's being used." Amir should have kept quiet. Around 1 p.m. on Christmas Day, he received a phone call in his room at the Sherry Biltmore Hotel in Boston. He was told that four newsmen wanted to talk to him about Ali's recovery. When one of the reporters asked if they could come up to his room, Amir became suspicious and said that he would meet them in the lobby. Stepping out of the elevator, he immediately recognized Clarence X. Puzzled, he asked the Boston captain if he had seen a group of reporters. But before Clarence could answer, a man struck him from behind. Clarence and his three henchmen kicked Leon until an off-duty detective came to his rescue. Later that night, after he received stitches above his left eye and returned to his hotel room, a group of men posing as investigators knocked on his door. When he opened it, they rushed him, swinging fists and clubs. Leon covered his face while they pummeled and kicked him, shattering his eardrum, breaking his ribs, and fracturing his skull. The following morning, a chambermaid screamed when she found him lying nearly lifeless in a tub, splattered with blood. Amir survived. Recovering from a coma, he spent 15 days in the hospital. On January 9, 1965, at a press conference in Harlem, he told reporters that he feared assassins would come after him again and that Ali's life was in jeopardy, too. Ali would not admit it, but he had expressed grave doubts about the integrity of certain powerful Muslims. He knew all too well what could happen to him if he so much as thought about leaving the nation. Siding with Malcolm, Amir began meeting with reporters, publicizing the violent threats the nation made against him. In an interview with the Amsterdam News, he divulged Chicago's order to beat and kill any member who joined Malcolm. Clarence X and the Muslims who attacked him were convinced that he was trying to drive a wedge between Ali and Elijah, and they were certain that only a man working for Malcolm would have told Ali to quit the nation. 3 days after Amir's press conference, on January 12th, Raymond Sharif and other high-ranking officials attended the annual Fruit of Islam banquet, an evening of dinner, music, dancing, and a guest appearance from the heavyweight champion. The Amsterdam News reported that more than 2,000 members from the East Coast packed the Audubon Ballroom, the same location where Malcolm held his weekly meetings. Located between Broadway and St. Nicholas Avenue on the south side of West 166th Street, the two-story building served as a dance hall and lodge for local organizations. What no one suspected, however, was that the Fruits party at the Audubon was just a ruse for planning an attack on Malcolm. Over the next month, members from the Fruit would hold several meetings at the Audubon in which they plotted Malcolm's murder. On this night, though, Ali enraptured the angry young men seeking vengeance against hypocrites, denouncing Malcolm as jealous and attention-starved. Malcolm believed the white press, which referred to him as the number two man, and became disillusioned, he said, sounding more and more like the nation's ministers. Ali did not know it, but he had become a puppet in the assassination plot against Malcolm. The following day, he became agitated when Robert Lipside asked about his relationship with Amir. Feigning ignorance, he replied, "Amir? Little fella? I think I remember a little fella who hung around camp, a little fella who liked to go downstairs and get me papers." Scribbling his answers in a notepad, Lipside encouraged Ali to keep talking. "Now I hear he's telling lies, saying he was my press secretary." Ali shrugged. But when Lipside persisted, the champ burst into a tirade. "Any fool Negro got the nerve to buck us, you want to make him a star. Jim Brown said something about the Muslims, and they made him a movie star." The truth, Ali ranted, was that Amir cheated on his wife with a young girl and stole money from the nation. Amir was nothing but a hypocrite. He got what he deserved. Stunned, Lipside had never heard Ali speak so cruelly. When the New York Times columnist inquired if Amir should really fear for his life, Ali snapped, revealing the depths of his disgust for Amir and Malcolm. "They think everyone out to kill them because they know they deserve to be killed for what they did." Talmadge X had put his guns away. During the months Malcolm traveled abroad, he had not heard from any of the New Jersey men who plotted against Malcolm. He figured that maybe his partners had cooled to the idea of killing the minister. "Nothing was happening," he recalled. "So I thought that maybe things were going to get better, man." But when Malcolm returned home, the cadre began meeting again. Sometimes they drove around Patterson, planning the perfect crime. Other times they canvassed New York, looking for Malcolm outside the Audubon. One evening they drove out to his home in Queens, planning an ambush, but when armed guards appeared, they sped away. The New Jersey hitmen were not the only ones stalking Malcolm. Around 11:15 p.m. on Friday, January 22nd, three Muslims rushed toward him when he stepped outside his front door. He quickly slammed the door, locked it, and called the police. By the time officers arrived, his attackers had disappeared. Betty lived in fear of his assassins knocking on the door at any moment. Late at night, she watched Malcolm stand near the front door, holding a double-clip automatic carbine rifle, his eyes scanning the shadows for the slightest movement. While he protected their home, Betty cried herself to sleep, fearing that her worst nightmare would come true by the time she awoke. Every time Malcolm left the house, she agonized that he would not return. On January 28th, he flew to Los Angeles to meet with attorney Gladys Towles Root and the two secretaries involved in the paternity suit against Elijah Muhammad. His cousin, Hakeem Jamal, and his friend, Edmund Bradley,
arrived at the gate about an hour before his plane was scheduled to land. While they waited for TWA Flight 9, Jamal noticed a heavy-set black man with a familiar face. At first, Jamal was certain that he had seen the man at the nation's meetings, but when the stranger bought a pack of cigarettes, he began doubting whether he was truly a Muslim. Later, after Malcolm checked into the Statler Hilton Hotel, Jamal saw the man from the airport again. Walking through the lobby, Malcolm noticed Minister John Shabazz, Captain Edward, and a half-dozen other men from Mosque No. 27. Spotting Malcolm, no one from the fruit moved. "They absolutely froze," Jamal recalled. When they hesitated, Malcolm and his hosts slipped out of the hotel and drove away. How could the fruit have known when Malcolm would be in Los Angeles and where he was staying? An official must be in town, someone from Chicago, Malcolm surmised. There were a lot of them in the lobby. I wonder if it could be Raymond Sharif or John Ali. When he mentioned John's name, Jamal immediately realized that he was the brother at the airport, the cat who was buying the cigarettes. Malcolm was right. John Ali was in town. But there was no way, he thought, that Ali and the black Muslims had the resources to track him from New York to Los Angeles. He knew their operations too well. Besides his wife, cousin, two aides, the two secretaries, and their attorney, no one knew about his flight to Los Angeles. Only the FBI could have known that he would be in California. And they did. About 2 weeks earlier, an informant had notified special agents that Malcolm planned to visit Los Angeles. Somehow, that information fell into the hands of John Ali. It was Malcolm's belief that John Ali had turned FBI informant. Nor was he the only one. Journalist Louis Lomax also suspected that Ali was working for the FBI. In 1963, when he published When the Word is Given, a study of the rise of the Nation of Islam, Lomax referred to Ali as a former FBI agent. According to FBI documents, Lomax's book threatened the anonymity of a highly placed informant inside the nation. In a series of memos, FBI officials considered telling Lomax about Ali's true status, though it's unclear if the Bureau ever approached Lomax about Ali. Nonetheless, Malcolm was convinced that the Muslims had a chain of informants working with the FBI and that the Bureau's agents gave the black Muslims his itinerary. After his meeting with Gladys Root and the two secretaries, Malcolm returned to the Statler Hilton. Surrounded by the fruit soldiers, he darted through the lobby, their angry stares piercing his body like daggers. He safely made it to his suite, but he hardly slept. His phone rang constantly throughout the night. One caller in particular rattled him.
"You are dead," an unfamiliar voice whispered. "You are a dead nigger."
Malcolm dreaded leaving the hotel in the morning, knowing that the fruit was camped outside. Holed up in his room, he waited for sunrise, like a prisoner on death row. Around 9:30 a.m., Edmund Bradley arrived to take him to the airport. Driving down the Hollywood freeway, two cars chased them. Accelerating to 70 miles per hour, Bradley zigzagged through traffic, shaking one of the pursuing vehicles. When the other car inched closer, Malcolm reached into the back seat and pulled out an old walking cane. Aiming it like a rifle, he pointed the cane out of the window, scaring the other driver enough to hit the brakes, allowing Bradley to race away. Eventually, after the Los Angeles police intercepted two more Muslim men at the airport, Malcolm boarded TWA Flight 26 for Chicago. For 3 days, the Chicago police guarded him. Somehow, he orchestrated a surreptitious meeting with Wallace Muhammad. Malcolm told Elijah's son that he had also met with the Illinois Attorney General's office, offering his testimony in a case involving a black Muslim prisoner who was suing the state for denying him the right to practice Islam behind bars. In exchange for protection, Malcolm had said that he would testify that the Nation of Islam was not a legitimate religious group, and therefore black Muslim ministers should not receive access to state prisons. More importantly, if he testified, he could cost the nation its tax-exempt status and, potentially, millions of dollars. On Saturday, January 30th, Malcolm taped a television interview with Chicago Sun-Times columnist and popular television personality Irv Kupcinet. Noticing that he had arrived under heavy police detail and with personal bodyguards, Kupcinet asked if his life was in danger. "They are trying to kill me," Malcolm said. "Who?" the writer asked. "You know who," he answered, vaguely. After the interview, he left the television studio in an unmarked police car with two detectives and two state attorneys. Driving toward his hotel, a van swerved in front of them, cutting off the police car. About a dozen Muslims swarmed them. Malcolm must have thought that this was it. There was no way two policemen could protect him from this mob. They were clearly outnumbered, until six more officers who had tailed behind them rushed to their rescue. Later, when the police escorted him to his hotel room, Malcolm recognized about 15 black Muslims loitering in the lobby. He told the detective, "It's only going to be a matter of time before they catch up with me." The time had come for Malcolm to head south and join forces with grassroots civil rights activists. On Thursday, February 4th, a day after he lectured at the Tuskegee Institute, he traveled to Selma, Alabama, where Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had organized a voting rights campaign. Facing a court injunction against demonstrations and relentless harassment from police, King led a march, landing himself in jail with more than 700 other protesters. While King sat behind bars, student activists from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee invited Malcolm to join a rally at the Brown Chapel American Methodist Episcopal Church. From the Christian pulpit, he exhorted the audience to use whatever means are necessary to gain the vote. He praised King's commitment to peace, but he reminded the congregation that he did not believe in nonviolence. "The white man should thank God that Dr. King is holding his people in check, because there are other ways to obtain their ends." When he finished speaking, he visited with King's wife, Coretta. He regretted that he did not visit Martin in jail, but he wanted her to know that he came to Selma to help him. "If the white people realize what the alternative is," he said, "perhaps they will be more willing to hear Dr. King." A day after returning home from Alabama, he flew to London for the first Congress of the Council of African Organizations. 3 days later, on February 9th, he traveled to Paris, but when he stepped off the plane, customs agents detained him. The Ministry of the Interior claimed that he threatened to disturb the public order, and therefore his presence was undesirable in France. Malcolm could not understand why he was being sent back to London. 3 months earlier, he had been welcomed in France. What had changed? Some writers have suggested that the French had learned that the CIA intended to kill Malcolm, and the government didn't want his blood spilled on its soil. Although there is no substantiated evidence supporting this theory, the episode in Paris made Malcolm reconsider who it was that truly wanted him dead. Malcolm could no longer rest comfortably at home. On February 13th, hours after he returned to the United States, he took a sleeping pill and dozed off. At 2:45 a.m., he woke to a startling sound. Whoom! A Molotov cocktail smashed through his living room window, torching the floor and the furniture. Whoom! A second firebomb shattered another window, scattering glass everywhere. Malcolm shook Betty awake, leapt from the bed, and darted across the hallway to grab his four daughters from their smoking bedrooms. Blinded by the smoke, Betty winced as she stumbled into the hallway. Bam! Another firebomb bounced off the back door, landing in the frosty yard, where it died. Rushing the screaming children and Betty through the kitchen, Malcolm swung open the back door and yelled at Betty, "Stay here!" Frightened, she and the children shivered outside, watching the brick bungalow burn. Malcolm hurried back into the five-room house to retrieve a few belongings, some coats, and a .25-caliber pistol. Quickly, he re-emerged, coughing, in a singed topcoat. 5 minutes later, the Queens Fire Department arrived, sirens blaring. Incensed, he paced barefoot, holding the gun at his side, while firefighters extinguished the flames. He could not believe that the Muslims would bomb a house containing four little girls, aged 7 months to 6 years. His assassins had sent a clear message. They would kill him by any means necessary, even if it meant murdering his wife and children. Malcolm increasingly sensed his murder was inescapable. "I won't burn to death," he said to the fire inspector. "I'll probably be shot to death in the street one day. Or maybe while I'm speaking." The following day, the press reported that the fire department had found a whiskey bottle filled with gasoline on his daughter's dresser. Harlem minister James 3X suggested that Malcolm planted the jug on his own, staging the fire for publicity. "Why," James asked, "would the Muslims torch a house that they owned?" "He is obsessed with the idea that we're after him," he told the New York Daily News. Later, Malcolm secretly met with a fireman who said that he had seen a man wearing a police uniform walk into the house carrying the jug. He had no doubt that someone was trying to frame him. In the days after the bombing, the black Muslims dismissed claims that they were trying to kill Malcolm. Muhammad Ali joined the campaign, discrediting the minister on the Irv Kupcinet show. "Malcolm was no better than a criminal," he charged, "a jailbird who could neither read nor write until Muhammad educated him." No one could trust anything Malcolm said, he maintained. Shortly thereafter, in the Hotel Teresa lobby, Ali ran into Betty. Scolding him, she said, "You see what you're doing to my husband, don't you?" Raising his hands in the air, Ali pleaded innocence. "I haven't done anything. I'm not doing anything to him." Yet Ali was not innocent. He had joined the chorus of violent ringleaders who raged about punishing Malcolm. As the most visible figure in the nation, his malicious attacks echoed throughout the country, further convincing Elijah's followers that they had to silence Malcolm. Without throwing a punch or raising a hand, Ali managed to hound the man he had once called his brother. Under siege, Malcolm threw a bomb of his own. On Monday evening, February 15th, he held a meeting at the Audubon Ballroom. More than 500 people gathered to hear him talk about his political agenda. Instead, he revealed another secret of Elijah Muhammad's, one that threatened to ruin his reputation as a defender of black citizens. In December 1960, Elijah had dispatched him to Atlanta, along with Minister Jeremiah X, to negotiate an agreement with the Ku Klux Klan. At the time, Muhammad had wanted to purchase farmland in the South, but he'd needed assurances that if the nation organized there, the Klan would let them live peacefully. As Muhammad's emissary, Malcolm had made it clear that the nation and the Klan both wanted the same thing, complete separation between blacks and whites. Malcolm regretted meeting with the Klansmen, he said, but the public had to know why it was that Muhammad never criticized or challenged the white supremacists. It was a risky revelation, but no more so than the insufficient security measures that he'd imposed. Earlier, Malcolm had instructed his security to cease frisking people who attended his rallies. He realized that he could not build a movement if people were too scared to attend his meetings. His lieutenants argued that he was risking his life, but he overruled them. "We don't want people feeling uneasy," he said. "We must create an image that makes people feel at home." During his speech, a commotion between two men in the audience drew Malcolm's security away from the rostrum, leaving him vulnerable to an attack. "Get your hand out of my pocket," a man shouted. "Just sit down and be cool," Malcolm implored the brothers. When a young man wearing a blue suit, white shirt, and red bow tie got up and started walking down the middle aisle, Gene Roberts, one of Malcolm's chief security guards, approached the stranger until the man ducked into a second-row seat. Everything seemed fine, so Malcolm continued speaking, but the incident made Roberts nervous. Certain that he had witnessed a dry run on Malcolm's life, he went home and wrote a description of the events. The details were essential if his real supervisors were going to do anything to protect Malcolm. In 1964, officials from the NYPD's intelligence agency, the Bureau of Special Services, BOSS, had directed Roberts, a 25-year-old detective, to infiltrate Malcolm's organization and get as close to the minister as possible. Gradually, he gained Malcolm's confidence and became one of his most trusted bodyguards. As soon as he thought that he saw the rehearsal of Malcolm's murder, he called his superiors. In response to the growing threats against Malcolm, the police offered the minister 24-hour protection, but he turned it down, insisting that his men were security enough. But Malcolm never had enough security. For more than a year, the black Muslims had stalked him, following his every move. In his private moments, he could not help replaying all the times that they had tried to kill him. Morbidly, he imagined how his life would end. He had dodged death too often to live much longer. When a friend called him to meet the following Tuesday, Malcolm somberly replied, "I'll be dead by Tuesday." On Friday, February 19th, Malcolm met with Life magazine photographer Gordon Parks. The photographer asked Malcolm if he really believed that his life was in danger. "It's as true as we are standing here," he answered. "They've tried it twice in the last 2 weeks." "Perhaps," Parks suggested, "the police would protect him." "Brother," Malcolm chuckled, "nobody can protect you from a Muslim but a Muslim or someone trained in Muslim tactics. I know. I invented many of those tactics." "Did Malcolm have any protection?" He laughed again. "Oh, there are hunters, and there are those who hunt the hunters, but the odds are certainly with those who are most skilled at the game." That same afternoon, John Ali checked into the Americana Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. In recent weeks, the official from Chicago had demonstrated an uncanny ability for being in the same city as Malcolm. The following evening, in Harlem, Talmadge X and his accomplices attended a dance at the Audubon Ballroom, inspecting the windows and exits one last time. According to one witness, later that night, Talmadge met with Ali, finalizing their plans. Everything was set. They were ready to kill for the messenger. 2 blocks away from the Americana, Malcolm checked into a room on the 12th floor of the Hilton Hotel at Rockefeller Center. Soon, a group of black men began asking the bellmen about Malcolm, probing for his room number. Someone notified the head of security, a former policeman, who knew that Malcolm had received numerous death threats. After escorting the men out of the hotel, the security chief added extra protection on the 12th floor. The next morning, February 21st, at 8 a.m., Malcolm's phone rang. An unfamiliar voice, a voice that sounded like it belonged to a white man, said, "Wake up, brother." Before he could even think of a response, the caller hung up. Hardly a moment passed when he was not reminded that someone wanted him dead. And yet, despite the constant danger, he called Betty about an hour later, inviting her and the children to his afternoon rally at the Audubon Ballroom. Initially, he had told her that it was unsafe for her to attend his public meetings. For some reason, this time, he changed his mind. That morning, Talmadge X and the brothers from New Jersey left Patterson in a blue Cadillac. Driving across the George Washington Bridge, they reviewed their assignments. After parking a few blocks away from the Audubon, the men scouted the building's perimeter. They confidently strode past Malcolm's security, concealing their weapons under long overcoats. They knew that no one would frisk them, since Malcolm had called off body searches at previous meetings. What they could not have known was that Malcolm had also directed his security to arrive unarmed, though at least one man disobeyed him, his bodyguard, Reuben Francis. The New Jersey group drifted into the second-floor ballroom, unmolested. Arriving earlier than most guests, the 5 men made sure that they found seats near the stage. With a .45 tucked into his pants, Talmadge sat in the front row next to Leon, who carried a Luger beneath his coat. Behind them sat William, hiding a shotgun, and Ben, the Newark secretary. Wilbur, the getaway driver, sat somewhere in the middle of the hall's 400 folding chairs. At 1 o'clock, around the same time the armed men headed for the Audubon, Malcolm drove his blue Oldsmobile uptown to Harlem, parking it at the southeast corner of Broadway and West 146th Street, 20 blocks away from the ballroom. He walked alone for a few blocks, perhaps, an aide suggested later, so that if his assassins tried to kill him, no one else would be harmed. Standing at a corner near a movie theater, he waited for a bus when a white Cadillac with New Jersey plates slowly pulled up beside him. Malcolm did not recognize the driver waving at him. Cautiously, he peered into the back seat and noticed one of his security guards, Charles X. Grinning with relief, Malcolm entered the back seat next to Charles, who then introduced him to his friends, sitting up front. Around 2 o'clock, Malcolm arrived at the Autobahn. As he approached the entrance, he passed a single police officer, Patrolman Thomas Hoy. Typically, 4 or 5 officers guarded the entrance, but someone from Malcolm's camp, supposedly acting on the minister's authority, asked the duty officer to reduce the police presence. 2 uniformed officers took positions inside the Rose Ballroom, adjacent to the main hall. Curiously, the police had discreetly assigned another 20 officers across the street at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. When Malcolm's aide, Charles Kenyatta, arrived at the Autobahn, he could not understand why people were not being searched. Reuben Francis insisted that he was just following Malcolm's orders.
"That's bullshit," Charles exclaimed. "You know he don't know what he's saying or doing. Y'all know better."
Malcolm slowly climbed the stairs up to the main ballroom, taking long, heavy steps. By the time he reached the second floor, he looked exhausted. Harried, an OAAU member recalled. Not fearful, but just like somebody who had a lot on their mind. Backstage, Malcolm sank into a metal folding chair and rested his elbow on a counter in front of an old vanity mirror. From the anteroom, he could hear the noisy crowd filling the ballroom. When he learned that the guest speakers had not arrived and that no one had printed his official program, he snapped at his assistants,
"Get out! Everybody! Get out!"
Restless, he bounded from the chair and began pacing, occasionally peeking out at the audience. He was more tense than I'd ever seen him, Benjamin 2X remembered. Without an official platform or a guest speaker, he sent Benjamin to give the introduction. "Make it plain," Malcolm instructed. A few moments later, he apologized to the aides who had returned to the green room. Anxious, he admitted, "I don't feel right about this meeting. I feel that I should not be here. Something is wrong, brothers." After improvising for more than 20 minutes, around 3 o'clock, Benjamin brought Malcolm on stage. Wearing a dark brown suit and a solemn expression, Malcolm stood behind the plywood lectern, a few feet away from an old white grand piano, a drum set, and a row of folding chairs. For more than a minute, the audience gave him a standing ovation. Right before he began, Gene Roberts retreated from his position near the stage and headed toward the back of the ballroom, leaving only 2 bodyguards standing in front of the rostrum. As the crowd continued clapping, Malcolm cracked a crooked smile. When the audience quieted down, he greeted them. "Assalamu alaikum," he announced. "Wa alaikum salam," the crowd rejoined. Taking a long, deep breath, like a boxer moving out of his corner before the first round, Malcolm began, "Brothers and sisters." Then it happened. A man in a black overcoat jumped from his seat, tossed a homemade smoke bomb, and shouted, "Get your hand out of my pocket!" Suddenly, 2 men in the middle of the audience were on their feet, entangled in a shoving match. Startled and confused, the spectators began yelling. Immediately, the 2 rostrum guards dashed toward the commotion, leaving Malcolm unprotected. Gene Roberts and several other security guards standing in the rear left their post too.
"Now, now, brothers," Malcolm urged. "Break it up. Be cool. Be calm."
At that moment, a large black man stepped into the aisle and raised a sawed-off, double-barreled shotgun.
"Hold it," Malcolm pleaded, extending his arm in the air. "Hold it." Boom.
The gunman pulled the trigger, blasting shotgun pellets through the plywood lectern, cutting a crater of holes in the center of Malcolm's chest. Malcolm staggered, rocking back on his heels. His body swayed backward, crashing into 2 empty chairs. His head slammed onto the hardwood, making a loud thud. The gunman fired again into his jerking body. 2 more shooters, Talmadge and Leon, streaked toward the stage, and sprayed him with bullets. Within seconds, it was over. Fleeing, the man with the shotgun fired above the crowd. "Get out of the goddamn way!" one of them yelled. Screaming and cursing, people ran for the exits, colliding into each other. Others helplessly dove onto the floor, tossing chairs aside. Covering her girls, Betty tried to shield them from the horror. "They're killing my husband," she cried. Hurdling chairs, Talmadge ran right at Jean Roberts, firing a shot at the undercover agent, grazing his coat. Roberts flung a chair at his legs, knocking Talmadge down. Rising from the floor, he sprinted toward the exit. Just as he reached the top of the stairwell, Reuben Francis fired three shots, clipping him in the left thigh. "Oh!" Talmadge screamed. Writhing in pain, he tumbled down the stairs. When he reached the bottom, a mob seized him. "Kill him! Kill him!" the horde shouted. Rushing toward the crowd, Patrolman Hoy grabbed onto the suspect's arm, yanking it like the rope in a tug-of-war. "They were trying to pull him apart the way you pull a drumstick off a turkey," one witness recalled. Moments later, two more patrolmen emerged from a squad car. When one of the officers realized that the crowd was winning the tug-of-war, he fired his revolver into the air, ordering them to disperse. Quickly, the patrolman shoved Talmadge into the back of the cruiser. The suspect, identified in the press as Thomas Hagen, was the only assassin caught at the scene. Inside the ballroom, Malcolm lay on the stage, his heartbeat still pulsing. The screaming had subsided, but people were still crying and moaning. "The whole room was a wailing woman," one writer recalled. A half-dozen people bent over him, while Malcolm's men paced furiously, regretting that they had not done enough to protect their brother. One fumed, "There ain't no goddamn hope for our people in this lousy country. You gotta fight them lousy whites and fight the stupid niggers, too. There ain't no goddamn hope." Frantic, Betty kneeled beside her husband, his white shirt ripped open and soaked with blood. Jean Roberts had tried to revive him, but by then it was too late. Betty attempted to resuscitate him too, frantically pumping his chest. Suddenly, she began digging through his pockets, searching for a paper that included the names of five men Malcolm believed would be responsible for his murder, a list that Betty never revealed. Clinging to the blood-stained paper, friends pulled her away, while a stretcher rolled into the dance hall. "Oh, Muriel," she sobbed to a friend, "he's gone, and I'm pregnant." Police investigators knew very little except that Malcolm was dead and that a wounded suspect was already being interrogated. Beyond those facts, they had more questions than answers. Why hadn't Malcolm's guards been armed? Why weren't the spectators searched? Why wasn't there tighter security near the stage? Was this an inside job? He was definitely set up for it, an investigator later told Newsweek writer Peter Goldman. To us, it was all so perfect. Nobody would have walked in there to shoot him unless you know nobody has a gun and unless you know you've got one key man in your pocket. Malcolm's men had questions of their own. The police knew that his life was in danger, and yet on the day of the murder, they deployed only two officers inside the Audubon and one outside the entrance. Why did the police hide 20 officers inside the hospital across the street? Did the police look the other way? Was the FBI involved? Malcolm had told his most trusted assistants that the FBI had agents working inside the nation, agents who deliberately exacerbated the feud between him and Elijah, knowing that it would lead to a bloody war. Malcolm's men did not doubt that Talmadge X and his accomplices belonged to the Nation of Islam. The real question, the one that has lingered for decades, was much simpler. Who sent them? Malcolm's murder enraged his followers, setting in motion a vendetta against Elijah Muhammad and the nation's most prominent members. After the FBI warned the Chicago police that Malcolm's avengers were headed to their city, the department placed heavy details at bus stations, train stations, and airports. Police cruisers and unmarked cars parked outside Muhammad's mansion, Mosque No. 2, and the offices of Muhammad Speaks. Under police protection, Elijah seemed safe. but around 10 p.m., a call went out over police scanners. A fire had broken out at a Southside apartment on Cregeer Avenue. While the fire burned for more than an hour, the police interviewed a resident who lived on the second floor. At first, they suspected arson because Muhammad Ali had an apartment on the third floor. Perhaps, the police surmised, Malcolm's men had planned to immolate the boxer while he slept. But after interviewing Ali's drunk neighbor, the man admitted that he had started the fire when he fell asleep on a sofa with a cigarette in his hand. Fortunately for Ali, when the fire occurred, he and Sonji were out dining after attending religious services. Earlier that evening at the mosque, one of the ministers announced that Malcolm had been murdered. Immediately, Sonji feared that her husband might be next. No one knew that they were eating dinner at the Arabian Sands Motel, but somehow, John Ali, who had already returned from New York, called to tell the champ that his apartment had caught fire. Arriving at his apartment with the national secretary, the boxer told Reuters that he was shocked and surprised that someone had killed Malcolm. The Nation, he insisted, had nothing to do with the murder. It was just a coincidence that the fire occurred on the same day that Malcolm was killed, he said. Privately, though, Ali told Sonji that somebody started it on purpose. The following day, Elijah held a press conference from his living room. He spoke impassively, denying any knowledge about Malcolm's murder. According to his grandson, Elijah was sitting in his office when he heard the news on the radio. "Oh my God!" he exclaimed. Speechless, he sat quietly for about 30 minutes until he said that he wanted to go home. When reporters asked him if he had ever heard of the suspect, Thomas Hagen, he answered, "He is a stranger to us." In the days leading up to the annual Savior's Day convention, officers escorted Ali everywhere he went. The police figured that if Malcolm's avengers could not get their hands on Elijah, they most certainly would try to kill Ali. On Tuesday, February 23rd, the morning after a firebomb exploded at Mosque No. 7, completely gutting the Harlem Temple, reporters hounded Ali. Anticipating open warfare, Reuters asked him if he feared death. "I'm with God. If I'm gonna die for truth, I'm ready to die. I ain't afraid. I ain't afraid of nothing." Facing death threats, he remained defiant, professing his faith in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Publicly, he maintained a loyal front, but his mother sensed that her son wavered about being in the Nation. "I heard he wants to quit the Muslims," Odessa said. "I hope he does." In her heart, though, she doubted that her son would actually leave Elijah. Ali never seriously considered breaking with him. He was in too deep. And now, as a spokesman of the Nation, he could show no remorse for the deceased. "Malcolm X was my friend, and he was the friend of everybody, as long as he was a member of Islam," he said. "Now, I don't want to talk about him no more." On Friday, February 26th, Muhammad preached for more than 2 hours at the Colosseum. Outside the old stadium on Wabash Avenue, the police set up a tight perimeter comparable to that for a presidential visit. 2 days earlier, they had received a phone call from a man who claimed that he had planted a bomb inside the stadium. Undeterred, Muhammad stepped to the podium. Surrounded by a phalanx of grim-faced troopers standing shoulder to shoulder, the fruit created a bulwark around the messenger. "Malcolm was a hypocrite who got what he was preaching," he declared, his voice cracking between coughing spells. "If he had not been a hypocrite, we could have given him a glorious burial. But Malcolm went around the country trying to slander me." Standing on the dais next to Louis X, Ali endorsed Elijah, clapping enthusiastically and repeatedly shouting, "Amen," and "Yes, sir." Muhammad's frail voice hardly carried in the cavernous arena, but the crowd followed Ali's cues, showering him with praise. "Sweet words. That's right. That's right." "If Malcolm had not turned his back on me," Elijah preached, "we would have stood over his body and prayed with tears of grief in our eyes." But no one on the stage, Not Lewis, not Ali, not Elijah, not even Malcolm's own brothers, Filbert and Wilfred, shed a tear. It's wrong, Muhammad reminded his followers, to even stand beside the grave of a hypocrite. Saturday, February 27th, felt like the coldest day of winter. Just before sunrise, mourners began lining up outside Faith Temple Church of God in Christ on Amsterdam Avenue. Braving the bitter chill, grievers quietly huddled together, their hands jammed into their pockets and coat collars pulled up to their ears. As the sun climbed the morning sky, the temperature rose to 14 degrees. Emerging from the subway, people extended the line, four abreast, down the block and around the corner onto 147th Street. Police barricades could hardly contain the overflowing crowd, estimated at 2,500. Earlier in the week, more than 20,000 people had viewed Malcolm in his copper casket at the Unity Funeral Chapel on 8th Avenue. Now, around 9:30 a.m., cameramen from WNBC began filming the funeral procession, capturing images of old women weeping and people hanging out of tenement windows, watching the action below. Police squads patrolled the sidewalks, while officers stationed on rooftops searched for signs of trouble. Inside the church, an old renovated movie house, Malcolm's glass-covered coffin lay beneath two murals of Jesus. Despite the Christian setting, Sheikh Ahmed Hassoun made sure that Malcolm received a proper Muslim funeral. At 9:45, Betty arrived, dressed in black, her face hidden behind a veil. Bomb threats, "We'll cremate Malcolm with firebombs," frightened the pregnant widow out of bringing her four daughters to the service. Escorted by Malcolm's security team and a group of policemen, she walked steadily toward the casket, tears streaming down her face, her upper lip quivering. When she reached the casket, she leaned toward Malcolm, who was wrapped in a white burial sheet, and kissed the glass that separated them. Surrounded by friends, family, newsmen, and photographers, Betty sat in a second-row pew, looking terribly beautiful and alone. Some of the most notable figures in Black America joined her, including Bayard Rustin, Andrew Young, John Lewis, and Dick Gregory. During his former friend's funeral, Muhammad Ali spent the day in Chicago performing a boxing exhibition at the nation's Unity Bazaar. Bounding around the ring in a white T-shirt, the champ looked overweight and sluggish, not yet fully recovered from his hernia surgery. The Muslims had expected a large crowd, but less than 10% of the Colosseum's 7,500 seats were filled. Ali did not seem too worried that the police and the FBI were watching him. It was no secret that there were men who had loved Malcolm more than he did, vengeful men, who were willing to kill the champ. "Shoot Clay, too," one of them said. "Why not? Why shouldn't we shoot him? Right in the ring, in front of all his people." If the death threats scared Ali, he showed no fear. Instead, he clowned for five rounds, playfully contorting his face while he taunted his brother and tossed a few jabs. When Rahman hit him in the fifth, he pretended that he was hurt and took a dive, provoking laughter from the crowd. On a day of mourning, columnist Jimmy Breslin could not understand how Ali could act so flippant, entertaining the same men who reveled in Malcolm's death. The champ had surrounded himself with the dull-minded, dangerous fanatics who will kill for this cult, just as they ran into the Audubon Auditorium in broad daylight and killed Malcolm X last Sunday. Watching the scene unfold, Breslin wondered if Ali ever really loved Malcolm at all. In New York, Malcolm's friend, playwright and actor Ozzie Davis, delivered a powerful eulogy. Looking out at the black faces in the packed church, Davis was reminded that Harlem truly loved Malcolm. The actor wanted the world to know that Malcolm was not a fanatic, a racist, or a violent demagogue. Those who cast Malcolm as evil never really knew him, he said. To Malcolm's critics, he asked, "Did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did you ever touch him or have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him?" Those who really knew Malcolm understood why the congregation honored him. Malcolm spoke for the powerless, the downtrodden, the voiceless black man. He was an authentic symbol of black pride, strength, and redemption, and he spoke the truth without cowering from whites. A champion of self-determination, he probed America's deepest wound, the gulf between the country's democratic ideals and its inequalities. Ultimately, he died in the struggle for black power. He died so that other blacks could live without fear, so that they could realize their dreams of freedom. Malcolm, Davis declared, was one of Harlem's brightest hopes. He was our manhood, our living black manhood. This was his meaning to his people, and in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. When Davis finished speaking, the pallbearers loaded Malcolm's casket into a silver-blue hearse. For 20 miles, a police escort led the 50-car procession out of the city, through Yonkers and Westchester, to the Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale, a hamlet in the town of Greenburg. Around 11:35, the convoy passed through the cemetery gates. In the pinewood section of the graveyard, 200 mourners gathered around plot 150, which was marked with a bronze plaque that read, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. After reciting the final Muslim prayers, a group of cemetery workers lowered the casket into the bottom of the cold, muddy grave. When the white workers grabbed shovels, a few of the brothers interjected. The undertaker told them that their caravan was already leaving. If they stayed behind, they would have no way to get home. "We'll walk," one of the mourners replied. When the brothers started tossing handfuls of dirt into the grave, the white men backed away, surrendering their shovels. The brothers picked up the tools, scooped the dirt, and filled the grave, while the last mourners watched in silence. "No white man," one of them said, "is going to bury Malcolm."
Context of white supremacy. That technically is the end of the book, but there is the epilogue to come. That will be our second audio segment today, and that will conclude things for Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, context of white supremacy. If you would like to participate, share thoughts, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to join the conversation, you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put in that address, tiny.cc/1race, put in that address, you'll see a link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. Click that link. It will open a small window on your screen. First line is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a code. It will ask for a name. You can use your real name. You can use a nickname. You can press random keys if you like. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button. button at the bottom. It will connect you to the program. You should hear us live, and it is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. You'll hear an audio prompt. Press the number 1, and we will get you on the line. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, again, this is our last session on this book. We'll be moving on to a new book next week, Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door. So any concluding thoughts, analyses, patterns, anything you want to get in about this book, today would be the day to do so. Mr. Demery Ford, Thomas in New York, Roz, your lines are all open. If you have commentary, feel free. I will look for other hands on the switchboard if other people have commentary to share as well. Folks have commentary. Everybody's line should be open. Folks have comments.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Wow, this is a pretty interesting section of the book. I missed some of the very, very beginning, but there was some things I wanted to touch on. There was a section on page 288 where they wrote, while King sat behind bars, student activists from his student nonviolent coordinating committee invited Malcolm to join a rally at the Brown Chapel American Methodist Episcopal Church. From the Christian pulpit, he exhorted the audience to use whatever means are necessary to gain the vote. He praised King's commitment to peace, but he reminded the congregation that he did not believe in nonviolence. The white man should thank God that Dr. King is holding his people in check, because there are other ways to obtain their ends. When he finished speaking, he visited with King's wife, Coretta. He regretted that he did not visit Martin in jail, but he wanted her to know that he came to Selma to help him. If the white people realize what the alternative is, he said, perhaps they will be more willing to hear Dr. King. And I found that to be very important, because regardless of what kind of vitriol was spewed between the two of those men, Mr. Malcolm fully understood the ramifications of his approach versus Dr. King's approach. And I found that to be one of the most brilliant things that he actually did when he was alive, in order to try and facilitate change in a manner in concert without the loss of black life. So even though he did not believe in nonviolence, I know from what I've read about him and what I've heard about him, he would have taken the path of least resistance, in my opinion, which would have been one that could have stopped the shedding of black blood, which kind of goes back to some of the stuff we discussed earlier in the book, where he made decisions when black people did want to do something physical to facilitate some sort of immediate change, and he stopped them from doing so. It wasn't because he was speaking rhetoric. It was because he just understood that the system was way more powerful than his ability to immediately affect change by exhorting the people in the crowds that were angry to go do something violent. And I thought that was just really great, in the fact that he was able to meet with Mrs. King and also give her that understanding as well, that essentially he was there in full support of Dr. King, and also that the intelligence of his strategy, and she actually talked about that as well. I read something years ago about that, so I just found that to be really brilliant. On the following page, they have a section that says, the following day, the press reported that the fire department had found a whiskey bottle filled with gasoline on his daughter's dresser. The Harlem minister, James 3X, suggested that Malcolm planted the jug on his own, staging the fire for publicity. Why, James asked, would the Muslims torch a house that they owned? He is obsessed with the idea that we're after him, he told the New York Daily News. Later, Malcolm secretly met with a fireman who said that he had seen a man wearing a police uniform walk into the house carrying a jug. He had no doubt that someone was trying to frame him. And I wish the race of that person was known, because I have a feeling it was probably a white person dressed in a police uniform. And I just venture to think that that was probably either one of the boss agents or the FBI. And if it was a boss agent, they would be working or doing this with the consent and, I would say, probably under the orders of the FBI. So I really found that to be a standout paragraph just in regards to how that situation unfolded and the fact that this fireman did report seeing a man in a police uniform going into his home. On page 293, there's a section that says, around 2 o'clock, Malcolm arrived at the Audubon. As he approached the entrance, he passed a single police officer, Patrolman Thomas Hoy. Typically 4 or 5 officers guarded the entrance, but someone from Malcolm's camp, supposedly acting on the minister's authority, asked the duty officer to reduce the police presence. 2 uniformed officers took positions inside the Rose Ballroom adjacent to the main hall. Curiously, the police had discreetly assigned another 20 officers across the street at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. When Malcolm's aide, Charles Kenyatta, arrived at the Audubon, he could not understand why people were not being searched. Reuben Francis insisted that he was just following Malcolm's orders. "That's bullshit," Charles exclaimed. "You know he don't know what he's saying or doing. Y'all know better." And this just really made me think. There was no question in my mind that his entire assassination was a complete setup by the FBI, boss agents in the police department, New York Police Department, and members of the nation that were either FBI agents or people they were able to coerce into putting their plot into motion. And I found the end of the paragraph where the brother Charles Kenyatta had discussed the fact that he didn't know what he was doing. I think that was telling, because in my opinion, and I'm not the only one who said this, I've heard Dr. Ben say this and numerous other African scholars long before I was even born say this, that we have to really, as a people collectively, take care of our own people when we know that they are putting their lives on the line in order to try and make things better for all of us, that we should supersede orders like that to protect their lives. And I understood exactly where he was coming from in that moment, because, you know, he wanted to protect the life of Minister Malcolm. Also, I believe, too, that Malcolm, before he went in that day, just based on what he discussed with the secretaries and the other people in the back, he knew somewhere in his heart that he was going to be killed. And I think part of the reason things unfolded like they did in regards to him, if he actually gave the orders for them not to have weapons and things of that nature, was in order not to have an exchange of gunfire around innocent people, all to protect his life. So I really look at his assassination, at least in the sense of he walked in there knowing that he would not walk out. And I think he did that in a lot of places that he went right shortly before he died. And the premise was to protect Black life, and he was willing to sacrifice his own life so that other innocent Black people, men, women, and children, would not have to be killed just on the behalf of saving himself. And I just find that to be one of the most selfless things that a Black person could do. It kind of reminds me of the story of Asar. I found this to be very telling. It's on page 299, where they write, "Standing on the dais next to Louis X, Ali endorsed Elijah, clapping enthusiastically and repeatedly shouting, 'Amen,' and 'Yes, sir.' Muhammad's frail voice hardly carried in the cabinet's arena, but the crowd followed Ali's cues, showering him with praise. 'Sweet words. That's right. That's right. If Malcolm had not turned his back on me,' Elijah preached, 'we would have stood over his body and prayed with tears of grief in our eyes. But no one on the stage, not even Louis nor Elijah, not Louis nor Ali, not Elijah, not even Malcolm's own brothers, Philbert and Wilfred, shed a tear. It's wrong,' Muhammad reminded his followers, 'to even stand beside the grave of a hypocrite.'" And I found this to be very, 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 very sad, in my opinion, just simply in the sense that white supremacy is so powerful that when it manifests in the form of acute anti-Blackness, the destructive force it can be on the black family, even to the point where Malcolm's own brothers sided with the people who essentially helped the FBI facilitate his murder against their own brother due to how racism, white supremacy manifested in his own family. And it's something that I've seen in my own family in regards to just how horrible it can manifest and just create such horrible, irreparable rifts in the black family. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about was on 301, excuse me. There's a paragraph that says, after reciting the final Muslim prayers, a group of cemetery workers lowered the casket into the bottom of the cold, muddy grave. When the white workers grabbed shovels, a few of the brothers interjected. The undertaker told them that their caravan was already leaving. If they stayed behind, they would have no way to get home. "We'll walk," one of the mourners replied. When the brothers started tossing handfuls of dirt into the grave, the white men backed away, surrendering their shovels. The brothers picked up the tools, scooped the dirt, and filled the grave while the last mourners watched in silence. "No white man," one of them said, "is going to bury Malcolm." And I found that to be one of the best examples of black self-respect in regards to them wanting to remove those subhumans from the environment so that they can pay the proper love and respect to this man for what he did for our people. And also I remembered Dr. Ben talking about that because he was there, actually, and he was one of the people who helped to facilitate filling the grave by hand. He didn't have a shovel. And it was one of the most solemn descriptions of a funeral I'd ever heard when I heard him speak about that. And I just find that to be just an incredible act of black self-respect for us to come together and do that for him. But again, like I said, I wish that we can come together and protect our people so that these sort of things either don't happen or at least we do the best that we can to prevent something like that from happening. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
I'm here.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir. Steve and Laz. Good evening to all the rest of the callers. Well, you know, I seem to think that if Malcolm was running the chapter of the NOI in Selma, that his speech would be a lot different. He wouldn't be doing all that tough talking down there. I mean, he could go down there one day and do that speech, but that wouldn't be happening every day in Selma in 1950. I really doubt that. And I think that, it's like you said, it was rhetoric. You know, it's a lot of tough talk, but, you know, you're going to provide an alternative. I mean, in Selma, I think they would have been really looking forward to that, and to having black people down here, thinking they were going to show out, they would have been pretty elated, those white people down here back then. I can't imagine, based off of, you know, living here in 2016, that a black man in the 1960s had the power to remove police from stations, have them go wait across the street, to have a cop go and save the bottle of whiskey inside of a house after it was bombed, to have three or four black men go risk their lives. I mean, they could have potentially been killed, you know, going to kill Malcolm. I mean, something serious had to make them do that, and I can't imagine that being no black people. I mean, really, I don't know how much, I mean, I can't imagine how much power could this dude have to make people do that, to have the cops move. It just doesn't seem logical at all. And I tend to think that, you know, white people have the way to get to black people and offer them some things, like, you know, maybe this is about to happen and, you know, this could happen. You know, this could happen to your kids, your wife, you know. Anything to influence them to go and risk their lives like that. I just can't see that coming from Elijah Muhammad, but I could be wrong. I wasn't alive back then. I just can't imagine someone having that type of power. As far as Elijah Muhammad goes, I think that his speech after Malcolm's death was very cold. I think that, you know, it would have been nice, even though it's just hindsight, but for him to probably give a much better representation of that Nation of Islam. I mean, he did minister there for a long time. He's dead now, and, you know, he went astray, but, you know, we always love him, and, you know, just leave it at that. I think that kind of leads to people thinking that they were behind it with that speech. And I just feel like I hate hearing that part where he just killed. I hated seeing it in a movie. In front of his daughters, in front of his pregnant wife. And I just can't see the police moving and all of that by some brothers with some shotguns, you know, get your hand out my pocket, nigga. I just don't see that at all. It had to come from real high up, and they also knew something was going to happen in the station right across the street. Also, today, the order on board one, for the most part, it's a BBQ's restaurant. This is a chain of barbecue joints out here. No picture of Malcolm in there or anything. So I'm pretty sad when you go in there to see, you know, if you ever go there to eat. It's no recognition that he was killed there. And the rest of it is they do still have the part of the stage and things, but I think they have his daughter has a Malcolm X museum there. It's very small, but the rest of it is owned by the hospital now, and it's pretty much little doctor's offices. And now I'll meet my wife. Thank
you. Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, Thomas and Ross. Okay, I'd like to start out with this because I may forget it later. Yuri Kochiyama, a Japanese-American political activist that, you know, in his last days, Malcolm didn't know who to really trust, and some of the people that he trusted, he probably shouldn't have, but some that he mentored went on and showed that they had, you know, love for him. This woman was family was held in a internment camp during World War II. We know how whites treated non-whites, especially Japanese Americans during that time. But she was one of the first to make it to the stage, and actually when Gene Roberts got there, it was rumored that he was just making sure that Malcolm was dead rather than, you know, giving him, but I did see a picture with him. Looked as though he was giving mouth to mouth resuscitation. So there's a lot of rumors and everything, but the pictures, you know, usually tell the story. And then there's Reuben Francis. I think he was a Cuban national. When this all broke down, he shot a Tal Nash X. So they were able to capture him. You know what is funny about this guy? I think this is the same one. He never testified at the trial, and then he just disappeared. They don't know. They don't have any death records of this guy, nothing, where he went, whatever. He just fell off the face of the earth. So then is John Allah. You know, he's the sinister character, and I believe probably the one that actually had the sawed-off shotgun, you know, when he shot Malcolm, you know, directly in the chest. And then leaving the scene after assassination and never apprehended, and wasn't even charged. The three men that was charged, the one guy, Talmadge X, even said the other two people weren't involved, but there were at least three shooters. And maybe more. And then, like the other callers said, it was funny that with all the police officers directly across the street, and then when Gene Roberts then moved the security team from the stage, you know, everything is kind of like it was orchestrated. And then you know, it just smells I thought it was interesting that Malcolm told Elijah's son that he had met with the Illinois Attorney General's office, you know, offering testimony in the case involving a black Muslim prisoner. You know, we were suing the state for denying him the right to practice Islam behind bars. In exchange for protection, Malcolm had said he would testify that the Nation of Islam was not a legitimate religious group, and therefore black Muslim ministers should not receive access to state prison. More importantly, if he testified, he would cost the nation its tax-exempt status and potentially millions of dollars. And the footnote is 20, and it's from, you know, two other different texts, one that Marvel guy, and, you know, so to me, you know, that is way out there because it's like it's an act to get back into the NOI, but then you go have them lose their tax-exempt status. I don't know. I got a problem with that somewhere, compute. But I'll move on here. When he went to France, you know, he was denied entry in there. And, you know, the reporters, see, the way he worded this is like some writers had suggested that the French had learned the CIA intended to kill Malcolm, and the government did not want his blood spill on its soil, although there's no substantiated evidence supporting this theory. You know, there's no evidence substantiating any theory to this point, but all theories are open. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's everything is in here. This guy working for Boss, you know, Bureau of Special Services. That was old Gene Roberts. And then I'll just say last what I believe it was Roz speaking on at his funeral when the white guys were getting ready to close the grave up. And I know this for a fact because at one time I worked as, you know, in a cemetery. Most of the workers in the cemetery, in these large, you know, cemeteries, were, it's just like old time, you know, when it was all black. You know, black people from the Civil War, they were burying soldiers. Now, all the way on up, blacks worked in these cemeteries. Now, to have a bunch of white workers there closing out a grave of a prominent black leader, that looks suspicious in itself, too. And we did study on medical apartheid and everything. And I'll say a couple more things. Buried in a copper coffin. You know, in America, copper is denomination of the lowest cent. And then burying him under those images of Jesus was kind of like desecration. And this one guy, Sheikh Hassan, he was a over 70-year-old man that had been assigned to with Malcolm X to help him in his spiritual journey. He made sure that he had a proper Muslim burial in the end. And I'll meet my line. Thanks, God. Take a call.
For sure, for sure. The caller at 5771, last four digits, 5771. Did you have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi. I'm fairly new to the show, and I was listening to the archives of the last couple of the study of Blood Brothers, and it's a very, very interesting, very, very breakdown, very, very interesting breakdown of the book, the way I'm looking at it, the way you guys are looking at it. But more importantly, you know, as most of the callers have understood by reading the book, is the words and the language that is being used. I mean, in this last session that's been going on, you know, Ali, you know, the authors are basically trying to make Ali complicit in, you know, Malcolm X's murder. And I, you know, and I'm pretty sure, because I don't have the book in front of me, but it's like I'm pretty sure there's no probably documents for it or anything that says that, you know, Ali had anything to do with Malcolm X's murder. But I guess, you know, with his attitude and, you know, towards trying to form an alliance with Elijah, they made this, you know, crazy assumption that, you know, he wanted Malcolm X killed. And this is, you know, it's interesting how the language here can divide, you know, black, you know, the black community like this, because, you know, just like with all the other callers that have said, you know, the Nation of Islam was heavily infiltrated by government agents. So you didn't know who was a government agent, and, you know, stirring up the anti-Malcolm sentiment that was going on in the nation, I'm pretty sure a majority of it was government approved in order for Malcolm X to be killed and have the Nation of Islam blamed. And I find it, you know, I find it interesting how they often say, like, when Malcolm was, you know, being paranoid of the CIA assassinating him, and it's like, that's not paranoia. That's well-documented fact. COINTELPRO did exist. So there was no, you know, there was no crazy fear that, you know, the government was trying to assassinate him. No, they were out to assassinate him. So there was no, you know, there was no paranoia there. He knew what was going on with his life, and he knew that they were using the Nation of Islam as pawns to accomplish this. And what was more interesting is the part where they were talking about Malcolm's when his house was firebombed. With you know, with his wife and his four girls at the time in the house. Well, that kind of reminded me of the four girls that got killed in the Birmingham church. So it's like, you know, and we all know that those were straight white supremacists and KKK members that did that deed. So sometimes when you do, you know, when you do things like that, you know, you have to point back to, you know, past crimes that has happened in a similar fashion. So, you know, the four little girls in a house and firebomb just reminds me of, you know, the Birmingham church bombings that happened a couple of years before that. So it's an interesting MO to me of what white supremacy, even back then, which was very aggressive, could do, you know, to leaders and, you know, to our children at that time. So I found that very symbolic in regards to that. So that's all the commentary I have, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. If other folks have commentary, please do not wait till the end. Go ahead and get your hand up if you have something you want to get in before we get to the epilogue, which will wrap things up. Some of the comments that I had, when they kind of start off this week, chapter 17, Worthy of Death, although there's no evidence that Elijah Muhammad sent his disciples a direct order to assassinate Malcolm in this climate, no such command was necessary. The vengeful language espoused at Muslim meetings and in the pages of Muhammad Speaks conveyed a clear mandate. Allah's messenger blessed those who struck back against the most dangerous hypocrites. And I think this has kind of been enforced throughout since Minister Malcolm's break, and even a little before that, the jealousy or vitriol that certain members of the NOI may have had for Minister Malcolm even before he left the nation, and then certainly afterwards, that this would have been enough to compel members to assassinate Minister Malcolm. At least in my view, I think if this is not presented in a larger context, as some of you all have already touched on, in terms of the counterintelligence program, I think if you read this book and you have read other texts that are contemporary of things that were happening at this time, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, Racial Matters, the FBI Secret File on Black America from 1960 to 1972, Jack Olson is mentioned in this book repeatedly. One of the other books that he wrote, which is much newer, they reference Black is Best in this book, talking about black athletes and racism in the 1960s. But Jack Olson wrote Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt, which is really, really good and extremely well footnoted. And it just deals with the roughly three-decade saga of Black Panther member and Vietnam veteran Geronimo Pratt and his deliberate false imprisonment as a part of the COINTELPRO program. I think, and there are many other, in my Carl Evans, The Judas Factor, there are many other phenomenal books that kind of deal with this period of time, not just on Malcolm X, even John Patash's book, The FBI's War on Black Leaders and on Tupac Shakur, FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, where this gets put into a much greater context, where you see the same types of programs where the system of white supremacy demands anti-blackness, demands that non-white people be in conflict with other non-white people. And then racists, they work to nourish, create, excite as much animosity between black people as possible, and then can even manipulate that directly, indirectly into producing some killing, bloodshed, further fights, animosities to totally disrupt any efforts towards liberation, replacing racism with justice. They do this phenomenally and they do it worldwide. But when you can see the same types of things, even I would say John Patash's book, where he talks about this sort of thing happening with Minister Malcolm and the Nation of Islam, this sort of thing happening with the Black Panther Party, which directly led to Geronimo Pratt being imprisoned falsely for 30 plus years, and other deaths and murders, the Black Panthers and the United Slaves, and then even moving all the way forward to the 90s with what they called the beef with the East and the West Coast with hip hop music, where you same thing end up with black people being killed, put in greater confinement, that they end up just doing the same type of thing over and over again. And it'll be very, very easy to just go and say, well, hey, you got, you know, whether it's Tupac Shakur and him talking bad about Sean Combs or Christopher Wallace or what have you. It'll be very easy to say, well, this sort of rhetoric, hey, you know, niggas, they're going to be ready to fight at the drop of a hat. Or Minister Malcolm said this about Elijah Muhammad and his followers were upset. And it's very, very easy to just say, well, see, he said this and they were upset, as opposed to really being able to look much, much deeper and seeing how all of this is being strategically orchestrated, manipulated, and even sometimes the people that are saying and doing things, they are not just black people that, you know, they're upset or whatever the case may be. These people might even be informants. These people might be working under direct orders from powerful whites, either their local police officers, FBI agents, CIA agents, whatever, you know, white supremacist enforcement agents. Next thing that popped out, Ali enraptured the angry young men seeking vengeance against hypocrites, denouncing Malcolm as jealous and attention-starved. Malcolm, and this is in quotes, Malcolm believed the white press, which referred to him as the number two man, and became disillusioned, he said, sounding more and more like the nation's ministers. Ali did not know it, but he had become a puppet in the assassination plot against Malcolm. I had many thoughts around this. I think this sort of verbiage has been employed in the text repeatedly, whether it's Muhammad Ali was some sort of puppet or mouthpiece for Minister Malcolm, or a puppet or a mouthpiece for Elijah Muhammad, that this notion that Muhammad Ali was just duped and used because of his influence and his fame as world heavyweight champion, even before he captured the title, that we can just use him to get our message out. And he's kind of ignorant, stupid, very malleable because he's not that smart. And so we can just, you know, just kind of tell him whatever, give him a little script to follow, and he'll just go out and repeat it verbatim. I think it very much has that tone. But also kind of at the same time, I do ponder on it, because beyond this book, if you read Carl Evans, you'll see photographs from some of the speeches that they're talking about, where you'll see Muhammad Ali on stage at NOI events where they are excoriating Minister Malcolm. And exactly as you heard it in the book, he's, you know, cheering them on and celebrating. Some of this stuff is directly quoted from him, where he's talking against Malcolm X. And I think For me, it just comes back to, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else will only confuse you. And the monumental importance, I put that in the description every week that we've been reading this book. And yes, the author suspected race soldiers. And, you know, I have certainly a lot of things in the book to me suggest a racist white supremacist agenda and how this book is constructed. I think many of the callers have pointed that out week to week. But I just go back to one of the people who said, hey, we should read this book. Since Muhammad Ali just passed, was this really should enforce the incorrectness, and not just the incorrectness, the counter-racist value of making every effort to not be out publicly talking bad and name-calling other non-white people. That's not saying that you have to agree with every single stance that they take on racism. Certainly not. That's not saying that you even have to, you know, quote unquote, like that person, find that person pleasing, find that person like somebody that you want to be around or you want to follow or support. It's not saying that at all. It's just understanding that in this system, it is so easy for racists to manipulate any sort of commentary where one black person is speaking against another black person. Even if you're not involved, and even if that's not your goal, that's not your purpose, whatever the case, you're not trying to direct anybody to do harm to that person or what have you, just that sort of commentary, they are so phenomenal. And this is just a matter of record. This is not my opinion. This is a matter of proven decades-long evidence. They are so good at being able to take that sort of thing and divert attention completely away from, let's neutralize the number one problem to black people worldwide on this planet, whites. It goes totally away from that to, you know, that Negro said such and such and such and such about you. What do you think? And that will end up becoming the brand new focus, whether it leads to violence, conflict, whatever the case they be. It just will end up consuming a lot of time and energy on squabbling, bickering with other victims of racism. Moving forward, I thought this should have been emphasized more in the text, in the context of how they constructed the book. Malcolm was right. John Ali was in town, but there was no way he thought that Ali and the black Muslims had the resources to track him from New York to Los Angeles. He knew their operations too well, besides his wife, cousin, two aides, and two secretaries and their attorneys. No one knew about his flight to Los Angeles. Only the FBI could have known that he would be in California, and they did. About 2 weeks earlier, an informant had notified special agents that Malcolm planned to visit Los Angeles. Somehow, that information fell into the hands of John Ali. Somehow. Now, they do go on to present information that Lewis Lomax and others suspected, it seems rightfully so, perhaps from the way that they've written this book, that John Ali was a highly placed FBI informant. Just in my opinion, I think it is a significant, deliberate act of racism, white supremacy, for that not to be more of the format. Yes, you can touch on whatever whatever Muhammad Ali had to say about Malcolm X, whatever Louis Farrakhan had to say about Malcolm X, whatever Elijah Muhammad had to say about Malcolm X, or any other members, any other black people that are in the NOI or not. You can focus on any, all of that. The main theme should be you have extremely powerful whites who have much bigger budgets than Elijah Muhammad, the NOI, much better training, many, many, many more people, global power and reach. These individuals had a vested interest against Minister Malcolm and any other black people that were working against racism, white supremacy, that were perceived to be a threat. And they've demonstrated, it's not a matter of conjecture, they have demonstrated, this is, you know, unequivocal. They have demonstrated carrying out plans to neutralize, including killing, black people in this time period. And maybe you don't find, of course you're not going to find an actual piece of paper that says, yes, we, you know, orchestrated killing Malcolm X or Fred Hampton or whomever else from this particular time period. But, I mean, there's so much overwhelming evidence and documentation of programs that they were carrying out and agents, informants, that sort of thing, that this should really be, in my opinion, this should be the primary focus in how we think about and understand this, even manipulating other black people to despise and talk bad about this black person. Even that should be looked at like they could be reading a speech because that sort of thing did happen, where black people would just, hey, read this. I think even some of Malcolm X's family members, I think one of his brothers was given a speech to read. He didn't even write it. They just put a paper in front of him and said, go on television and read this. He hadn't even had an opportunity to review it. It's in the PBS documentary, Make It Plain, that it's about a 2-hour film. It's fantastic. But he says that they just gave him a script to read, and it's all these nasty things about Minister Malcolm, and he's crazy and all this other stuff. I mean, really putting in different context, even if it is a black person, a direct quote where they're saying something bad about a black person, that might be what they have been told to say. Moving forward, even the part where they talked about, I think Thomas in New York mentioned it, or it might have been Mr. Demery Ford, whichever, where it's discussed that Minister Malcolm, in order to get protection from police, he was going to help a black person who was in greater confinement to see that he got access to study Islam while he was in prison. And then also in order to, I guess, compensation for him getting police protection, he was going to testify against the Nation of Islam that they were not a quote-unquote legitimate religious organization. This might jeopardize their tax status. Again, this is the sort of thing just realizing white power. I am very, very sure. I could be in error, but I cannot see how. If whites at that time, or right now, 2016, if they wanted to revoke the religious status of the Nation of Islam, and that means that they lose their tax status and any other privileges they get being recognized as a quote-unquote legitimate religious organization, whatever that means, I'm sure they could do that without Minister Malcolm testifying to anything. That, to me, just seems to be the type of thing that would lead you to think, well, see, Elijah Muhammad, the Nation of Islam, they would have a financially vested reason to kill Malcolm X. It would lead you to think that sort of thing. But again, I strongly, if they want to do that, they could do that right now. And I'm sure they could have done that at any point in the 1960s, 70s, even earlier than that. If they really were tired of all this and were tired of hearing about Yaqub and NOI and Fruit of Islam and all your ramblings and As-Salaamu Alaykum, okay, fine. You're revoked. You're not going to have your tax status. And moving forward, I've seen no instance where the IRS, the federal government, has had any problem in dealing with Negroes. That's now, 50 years ago, 50 years in the future, as long as the system of white supremacy exists. Moving forward, let's see. The whole point about the assassination was very, very sad to hear all of that narrated again, where they talk about that entire setup. I think Carl Evans and the Judas Factor and quite a few other sources that review what happened with the assassination at the Audubon Ballroom, the removal of enforcement officials from someone whose life had been threatened repeatedly. His house had just been firebombed suspiciously a week previously, and all the other threats and attempts on his life, as well as just this whole climate of violence at this time period, where you just had the president of the United States assassinated under suspicious circumstances a little more than a year prior to Minister Malcolm's assassination. Just violence upon violence upon violence against black people and worldwide, even against white people at this time in the country. How is it that you have the police presence removed from someone who is supposed to be under police protection? And I think even it's John Potash and some of the people talking about what happened with Tupac Shakur, who was under surveillance. How is it that you have all of these black people that are under astronomical surveillance who end up being killed publicly? How does that continue to happen? Dr. King, Minister Malcolm, Fred Hampton, Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G. It's a long, I'm just going off the top of my head here. I'm sure if I actually sat down and went through my notes, that list would be huge. The number of black people over, you know, a 30, 40 year time period that are under surveillance for whatever reason, and they end up being killed publicly, suspiciously, and then you end up not having the people arrested, or there ends up being a lot of controversy and questions about if there were people arrested. Did you get everybody? Just all of this, where you have all of these unresolved questions. How does that continue to happen over and over and over? To me, that right there reveals who is ultimately to blame. I think what Mr. Fuller says, the people that are most to blame are hiding in plain sight, and those people always, always, always are white. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. But having all of these enforcement officers not at the Audubon Ballroom, but to have them nearby at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, if you're going to remove the police presence, then you would just remove them. Why would you have them moved across the block as though they are prepared for something? That in and of itself says a lot. I think people have talked about Gene Roberts, his role in Boss. I think there was another prominent assassination of a black person where there was a shooting where Gene Roberts also happened to be one of the first people who was on the scene. That's one you can go and investigate yourself. There's a documentary, The Assassination of El-Haj Malik Shabazz, where they talk about the role of Gene Roberts and what he was doing. Was he there on the orders? I think he gives an interview. I think that also was brought up in the PBS documentary, Make It Plain, where I think he also makes an appearance in that film as well. Just for them to state that they thought it was done perfectly. Was this an inside job? Was the NOI to blame? In my view, I would think I would tend to focus on the people that have the most power and the most expertise and training. I think NYPD, the FBI, even the CIA, since they've been surveilling him when he's moving worldwide abroad, I would think that they would have far more sophisticated, reliable, efficient, effective training at carrying out assassinations, murders, particularly being able to do this sort of thing covertly so that they are not to blame than the Nation of Islam. That's just my opinion. I think the same thing as Thomas said. I seriously doubt Elijah Muhammad would have the ability to move NYPD officials in mass numbers, to move them away from the scene of a murder. I seriously doubt that they would be able to do such a thing. And if we want to be completely honest to make sure we pull in everything, it was not just the Nation of Islam who had lots of nasty things to say about Minister Malcolm. You can go and read the New York Times from the day Minister Malcolm was assassinated and many other white mainstream publications where they were just as nasty as whatever is being said in this book about the Nation of Islam and Muhammad Ali. He got what he deserved. He was a minister of hate and violence. You preached violence, you die by violence. That was pretty much the universal tone that whites take. In fact, it is very similar the way that whites talk about some white people talk about Malcolm X now, as though they have some reverence or appreciation for what he did. It's the same as the way whites, when Muhammad Ali died, and talking about, oh, he's such a great inspiration, he's such an American, blah, blah, blah. That is not the way that they talked about him in 1960. It is the same thing for Minister Malcolm X. That is not the way that they talked about him at that time. Even the day that he died, he was just a no-good, rabble-rousing, violent nigger that got what he deserved. That is the general tone, and I would encourage folks to go check, as I stated, mainstream publications, mainstream outlets, and see what they were saying about Minister Malcolm at that time, and kind of match it up to the rhetoric that you hear now being spewed about him. I will stop there. If other folks have additional comments that they want to make sure they get in, we have about 10 minutes, maybe a little less, before we get to the second audio segment. Feel free. And just again, remind folks, because I thought that was really important. I think Roz emphasized that last week, the attempted poisoning of Minister Malcolm when he was in Egypt. That was completely omitted last week. I thought that was one of the most significant acts of white supremacy in the entire text. Again, I seriously doubt the Nation of Islam would have had the reach to do that sort of thing. That's what I mean in terms of putting things in context when we look at and think about not just what happened to Malcolm X, but many, 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 many other black people worldwide who are working against racism, white supremacy, the exact primary problem that Minister Malcolm was focused on. Any other commentary folks wanted to get in?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Thomas.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, Gus, because I was going to say that. I mean, how did they reach all the way over and overseas? This is the Nation of Islam. This isn't, like, the Catholic Church probably has that type of reach, but, you know, not the Nation of Islam. Another name you left out, Haile Selassie, died in the, I think it was the 90s, Dr. Khalid Muhammad. And kind of under the same pretenses, he was doing a lot of talking that the Nation of Islam, from the way it was spent back then, was afraid they would lose their 501c3 tax exempt status from the things he was saying, and they kind of parted ways with them, and all of a sudden it made it look like Farrakhan has something to do with killing him as well. And just to bring everything home from what you said, if the CIA, the FBI are surveilling all these people, but they still end up getting killed, and no one suspects the FBI. But then when notorious B.I.G. got killed, his mother was able to get a wrongful death suit, and you come to find out that it was a police officer who confessed to killing him, but he was given immunity. And that's why she was able to get that wrongful death suit, I think, for $4 or $5 million, which today's term is, I think, $6 million is what they get for killing black people today. So, they're the most surveilled people in the world. And in fact, I would go on to say they could solve any murder that happens in the black neighborhood if they wanted to stop the murders. I mean, they have cameras everywhere. They have all kinds of technology. They probably know this, but they're not going to be able to live under that type of surveillance because they have the technology and the resources to surveil everything. And I mean, Mom,
can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, brilliant and salient points, Thomas. I just wanted to actually chime in with in regards to the killing of Notorious B.I.G. I find it's very telling because when you study that murder, he actually was being tailed by the FBI up until minutes before he was gunned down. So essentially, when you look at the way that Big was set up, it was basically identical to how Minister Malcolm was set up. In the same way, they said, I think it was like maybe a half an hour before he was gunned down, that magically these two FBI agents who were tailing him were nowhere to be found. And I remember seeing an interview where they interviewed Little Caesar, and he talked about the FBI coming to see him in New Jersey when he was staying at Big's house, and that he said they were pulling out pictures. And he said these were pictures from way back in early when Big first started to take off. So, and he said he was shocked with the pictures that they had because he didn't know they were watching them for that long. And he said the police would ask him, well, who's this? And he would say, that's me. So he saw himself, and they didn't even know it was him in the picture. And then they basically would ask him who each of the different people in the pictures were, and they were all, it was Big, and then all the different members of his crew, including himself. So when you speak of all of the surveillance that these people are under and the fact that this is like a complete setup, it's just there's no other way of looking at it. You know, the difference is who they use to commit these killings. In some cases, it'll be federal agents themselves. In other situations, it'll be other black people they can convince to do things for them. In other instances, it'll be police officers. So that's what I wanted to chime in with because I just find it very telling that, like you said earlier, the exact same methods keep being used. And I just think it's because we haven't studied them and studied history long enough to start doing things to preemptively thwart these sorts of machinations by racists. Thank you.
I just would like to say that the fire that started at the apartment complex was suspicious. And then when they made the report, they was making it look like that maybe it was an attempt on Muhammad Ali's life because he had an apartment on the third floor, but he wasn't even there at the time. And then they only mentioned that they interviewed two people, and one was a drunk that admitted to setting the fire, letting the cigarette burn the couch, you know. And, you know, it's just like a likely story. It acted as a diversionary tactic. And then one last thing, when Malcolm X was killed, during his friend's funeral, Muhammad Ali spent the day in Chicago performing a boxing exhibition at the Nation's Unity Bazaar. And I just thought that, you know, the way they present that, you know, it's bad as it is, but then to present it in the sight like he was actually cheerful about the man's assassination, I thought that was, you know, a racist attempt. And I'll mute my line on that Thanks.
Right on. Before we get to the second audio segment, I did recall, I think it was in 2014 when we had Dr. Niana Rasayan on the program, and he cited Life magazine. They did a front page report right after the assassination of Minister Malcolm. This is 1963, where they had one of the NOI mosques in New York that was burned suspiciously, and they put a the front cover for the Life magazine article, and you can check it out online. I think I've posted the picture before, but it's "Death of Malcolm X and the Resulting Vengeful Gang War: A Monument to Negro Upheaval." This is Life magazine from 1993. But as I said, just checking some of the white mainstream outlets and this sort of fanning, yes, it was, you know, just hooligan Negro, Negroism that resulted in all of this. And this is about the most you can expect from Negroes that are, you know, running around and talking about their being mistreated and what have you. Look at how they treat one another. Same type of thing you hear now, black on black crime. Also thought, just kind of making some of the same connections, John Patash, the FBI's war on Tupac Shakur and black leaders, just the ongoing nature of all of this and just compiling records and watching people for generations. I think he makes the point, Tupac Shakur being under surveillance from the time he was born because of his mother's activities. I am pretty sure that J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI officials, I'm pretty sure that they were aware of Minister Malcolm probably early on just because of his father's involvement in working against racism, white supremacy, and dying under suspicious circumstances. That tends to be the case. If you have parents or other family members who are active working against racism, they tend to follow and track. If this is going to be a generational type thing where your whole clan is going to be a problem for racist man, racist woman, racist child deciding that you want to be actively engaged in working against that. And I think that is important because I think John Patash in this book, he said Tupac Shakur was being followed while he was going to school and everything else. Again, I just don't think that you have black organizations, whether you want to say Diddy, Bad Boy, Nation of Islam. I just don't think that they have the type of resources to do that sort of thing, to just follow people for decades, for the duration of your life and have files and to know you intimately. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. Once again, they are not ignorant about racism. That is one of the greatest lies in the known universe. We will pause there. I was also going to say with that fire with Muhammad Ali, it's been my experience. Racists, also, they are very good at sending messages to other black people. I think that could have been a message of sorts. To Muhammad Ali, that don't think that, you know, something similar couldn't happen to you. I could be wrong, but I think John Patash talks about that a lot as well, messages being communicated to black people if you, you know, are getting out of line or if you just want to know, you just want to be reminded of the amount of power that we have over whether or not you live, whether or not we allow you to continue fighting, who's in charge. They can kind of send you reminders from time to time just in case you seem like you need a reminder. We will get back to the text. This is the epilogue, Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. The co-authors, again, Johnny Smith and Randy Roberts, both white males. So this is our final session. Got anything else you want to make sure you get in? Jot a note, write it down, make sure you get it in before we wrap up today. Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number 2.
Epilogue. Once the hate is gone. Cassius Clay will be the first heavyweight champion in history to train in a bulletproof ring. David Gordon, Boston Globe, February 23, 1965. A poisonous mood pervaded Muhammad Ali's camp as he prepared for his rematch against Sonny Liston. The atmosphere surrounding the fight was ugly, Jerry Eisenberg recalled. Malcolm was dead, and there were rumors Ali was going to be killed, maybe in the ring, in retaliation. At one point, a week or so before the fight, while Ali was getting a rubdown after a workout, a reporter asked him if he had heard the stories about Malcolm's people coming after him. He lifted his head angrily, a cruel note in his voice. What people? Malcolm ain't got no people. In the days leading up to the fight, the rumors intensified. Supposedly, carloads of heavily armed men, Malcolm's men, had left New York, headed for Ali's camp. There were other tales, too. One story held that the Nation of Islam had threatened to kill Liston unless he took a dive. Other scuttlebutt suggested that the Nation would discard the champ if he lost, but Ali refused to believe a word of it. Lies! All lies! He shouted during a news conference. The hell with Malcolm's boys! He erupted, pounding a table with his fist. Who are they? Paranoia swept through the St. Dominic's Arena in Lewiston, Maine. On May 25, 1965, security guards scrutinized every black man who walked through the turnstiles. Officers searched purses, briefcases, and coat pockets. Hours before the contest, they combed the old hockey stadium, searching for poison gas bombs. The match was originally scheduled to take place in Boston, but a few weeks before the fight, Massachusetts authorities refused to sanction it, claiming that the promoter had ties to organized crime. The fight moved to Lewiston, an impoverished textile town and unlikely site for a heavyweight title match, leaving the Muslims increasingly suspicious that Ali was being set up. Unconvinced that the police had thoroughly searched St. Dominic's, Clarence X inspected the air vents in Ali's dressing room, afraid poison gas would be shot into it. All the talk about a murder in the ring contributed to the pathetic turnout. Officially, the ring announcer declared the evening's attendance to be 4,280, but Sports Illustrated's Tex Mall reported that there could not have been more than 1,200 fans present, and even fewer of them actually saw how the fight ended. It all happened in the blink of an eye. After the opening bell rang, Ali stormed toward Liston, hitting him with a hard right cross. For about a minute, they danced as Ali moved clockwise, his head high and his gloves low. He moved cautiously, looking for an opening. Plodding toward Ali, Liston tried to cut off the ring, pawing at the champ. Liston tossed a few amateurish jabs, lunged forward, and lost his balance. At that moment, Ali leaned back, dodging Liston's punch. Quickly, he planted his left foot and snapped a short, chopping right, flush on Liston's chin. Sonny collapsed as if a sniper had shot him. But only his reputation died that night. A chorus of boos rained from the stunned fans. Fake! Fake! The crowd shouted. Few ringside observers could believe that Ali's single whipping punch had knocked Liston down. Sports writers labeled the final blow the Phantom Punch, implying that Ali never actually hit Liston, or at least he had not hit him hard enough to end the fight. Upon review of the fight film, and with the benefit of slow-motion technology, writers determined that Ali perfectly delivered a hard, blurring right. He threw the final punch at precisely the right instant, the moment Liston lost his balance and fell toward him, exposing his chin. Sonny never saw it coming. Sprawled across the canvas, Ali loomed over him, his right hand cocked, muscles flexed, shouting, "Get up and fight, sucker!" Neil Leifer, a young photographer from Sports Illustrated, snapped an iconic picture of Ali towering above Liston, taunting the fallen fighter. That photograph would become the most recognizable and enduring image of him during the 60s, capturing Ali's essence, his strength and beauty, his arrogance and boldness, everything that made Americans love and hate him. The athlete of the decade, Jimmy Cannon opined in 1970, has to be Cassius Clay, who is now Muhammad Ali. He is all that the 60s were,
it is as though he were created to represent them. In many ways, Ali personified the cultural changes of his times. During the decade, he became the most important athlete in America, a controversial figure who transcended sports, shaping cultural debates about race, war, and religion. More than any other athlete, his life fused the political upheavals of the age. His entire boxing career was defined by the social and political movements of the decade. This became more evident in early 1966. The United States military had lowered its threshold for intelligence exam scores, leaving him eligible for service. On February 17th, after the Louisville Draft Board denied his request for deferment on numerous procedural grounds, Ali received dozens of phone calls from reporters. Confused, he could not understand why the government suddenly wanted to send him to Vietnam. The Muslim brothers hanging around his Miami house tormented him with frightful predictions that Uncle Sam would soon tighten the noose around his neck. One of them said, "Some cracker sergeant is going to drop a grenade down your pants and blow your balls off." Flustered by the television crews gathering in his lawn and the calls, Ali became agitated. When a reporter asked him for what seemed like the 100th time what he thought about the Viet Cong, he finally snapped. "Man, I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong." Ali's memorable line splashed across the front pages of the nation's newspapers. His defensive outburst made many Americans despise him even more than they already did. Critics excoriated him as an unpatriotic coward, calling for boycotts of his matches. Amidst an escalating anti-war movement, establishment writers portrayed him as a spoiled brat, no better than the draft dodgers on college campuses. "Squealing over the possibility that the military may call him up," Red Smith charged, "Cassius makes himself as sorry a spectacle as those unwashed punks who picket and demonstrate against the war." While Ali's draft status threatened his boxing career, his personal life unraveled. When his contract with the Louisville sponsoring group expired that year, Herbert Muhammad became his exclusive business manager, gaining greater control over his life. Herbert strongly disapproved of Ali's wife because Sanji frequently questioned the directives Muslim authorities gave her husband. Her disobedience, Herbert claimed, made her an unfit wife. About a month before his military reclassification, Ali divorced Sanji, claiming that she had not adhered to the tenets of the Nation of Islam, as she promised. Sanji contended that Herbert had pressured him into the divorce. Facing alimony payments, Ali had filed an appeal on the grounds of financial hardship. Now, after his draft status had changed, he protested that his previous purses were tied up in litigation and therefore he could not afford to pay alimony unless he continued boxing. On the same day that the Selective Service announced his appeal, a New York judge sentenced Talmadge Hayer and two other men to life for Malcolm's murder. Hayer confessed his involvement in the assassination, but insisted that the other defendants, Norman 3X Butler and Thomas 15X Johnson, were innocent. "I just want the truth to be known that Butler and Johnson didn't have anything to do with this crime," he said. "Because I was there, I know what happened, I know the people that did take part in it." During the trial, Hayer never disclosed who ordered the hit on Malcolm. More than a decade later, though, he filed affidavits naming four other alleged accomplices. New York authorities, however, refused to reopen the case. Muhammad Ali never talked about the murder trial. He had other problems on his mind. On March 22, 1967, a few weeks after he received military orders for induction, he anxiously sat in his hotel bed, unable to sleep, his eyes downcast, contemplating his uncertain future. Around 2 a.m., Sugar Ray Robinson knocked at the door. Robinson worried that the draft pressure was taking its toll on him. He reminded Ali that he needed sleep if he was going to defeat Zora Folly later that evening. "What's wrong, champ?" he asked. "The army," Ali answered, with trepidation. "They're gonna want me soon, but I can't go." "But you have to go," Robinson argued, without mentioning that he had been accused of desertion during World War II. "What's this can't?"
Elijah Muhammad told me that I can't go. The nation's separatist principles would never allow him to serve alongside whites. You won't see a gun, Robinson maintained. Ali would just have to fight some exhibitions like he and Joe Lewis had. It'll be a snap. If you don't, they'll send you to jail. Pick up your license. Ali risked everything if he refused to serve. His title, his career, his income, everything. Well, Elijah Muhammad told me, he said, conceding his future to the messenger's wishes. Forget the old man, Robinson urged. Is Elijah going to go to jail and all those other Muslims? But I'm afraid, Ray, he admitted, with tears in his eyes. I'm really afraid. Afraid of what? Of the Muslims if you don't do what they told you? Ali would not answer. Robinson pressed, but the champ remained silent. When Robinson recalled the story for a writer, he said, If you ask me, he wasn't afraid of jail. He was scared of being killed by the Muslims. Muhammad Ali would not give boxing exhibitions for the army, nor would he fight the Viet Cong. Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs? He asked a reporter from Sports Illustrated. If I thought going to war would bring freedom and equality to 22 million of my people, they wouldn't have to draft me. I'd join tomorrow. But I either have to obey the laws of the land or the laws of Allah. I have nothing to lose by standing up and following my beliefs. We've been in jail for 400 years. On April 20, 1967, Ali refused induction at the U.S. Armed Forces Examining and Entrance Station in Houston. He proclaimed that he was a conscientious objector, opposing all wars undeclared by Allah. Immediately after he refused induction, before he had been charged with a crime, the New York State Athletic Commission suspended his boxing license and withdrew his heavyweight title for conduct detrimental to the best interests of boxing. Athletic commissions across the country followed New York's lead, forbidding his presence in the ring. On June 20th, a federal court convicted him of draft evasion, sentencing him to the maximum 5-year imprisonment and $10,000 fine. For the next 3.5 years, during his appeal and the prime of his boxing career, he was banished from the ring. Although he never went to prison, his fans believed that the government and the boxing authorities that banned him from the ring had already shackled him. Without boxing, Ali fell on hard times. In early 1969, during a paid television interview on ABC's Wide World of Sports, he complained to Howard Cosell that he was nearly broke and that he would return to boxing if the price was right. Infuriated, Elijah Muhammad immediately suspended him for failing to follow his teachings of prudence. In the pages of Muhammad Speaks, the messenger announced that Ali was barred from all NOI meetings and speaking with its members. The nation would no longer recognize him as a Muslim. Giving him back his slave name, Elijah declared, "We will call him Cassius Clay." In Elijah's view, Ali had made a grave mistake, placing his hopes and trust in the enemy of Allah for survival. When the 27-year-old boxer suggested that he would sacrifice his religious principles for the white man's money, Elijah decided to make an example out of him for those who are weak in the faith. Ali's experience in the nation now mirrored Malcolm's. Like Malcolm, he outwardly worshipped Elijah. When Elijah suspended him, Ali was crushed. He hoped that the messenger would eventually forgive him and welcome him back into the movement. Yet, without boxing, Ali had lost his value. Without the ring, without that world stage, he was just another acolyte. In his weakest moment, when he could not raise money or generate good publicity for the nation, Elijah disowned him, casting him outside the nation, as he had done to Malcolm before him. In exile, Ali remained loyal to Muhammad, refusing to blame him or the nation for his troubles. Dick Shop, who had known Ali since 1960, never understood his fealty to the messenger.
Often, when the writer asked him why he sided with Muhammad instead of Malcolm, Ali refused to answer. He had no words, no explanation. His expressive face has turned blank, Shop wrote in 1971. His enthusiasm turned to dullness. Maybe he is embarrassed. He should be. The truth, George Plimpton thought, was that Ali was afraid. He did not dare cross Elijah Muhammad. Once, when Plimpton visited Ali in Chicago, they drove around the South Side. When the writer asked him to see the leader's mansion, Ali agreed, but he drove so fast that Plimpton only got a fleeting look at it. Plimpton urged him to turn around so that he could take another look. Accelerating past the mansion at 50 miles per hour, Ali made another pass, insisting Plimpton slouch out of sight. He didn't want to be spotted, the writer recalled. I think he understood what they could do. They were intimidating. And because he did fear them, he was malleable. Malcolm's ghost haunted Ali. In early November 1974, 3 years after the Supreme Court overturned his draft evasion conviction on a technicality, he returned to Louisville for a celebration. He had just regained the heavyweight title from George Foreman in Kinshasa, Zaire. More than 7,000 fans greeted him outside the Belvedere, a riverfront plaza of parks, trees, and fountains overlooking the Ohio River. At the reception inside the Galt House, Ali enjoyed the singularity of being champion again. Sitting with white reporters from the Louisville Courier-Journal, he boasted about his comeback. Suddenly, his mood changed when two stone-faced men from the Fruit told Ali that it was time for him to go. "No, leave us alone," he snapped. "These are my people. These are my Louisville men. They can stay as long as they want. Don't bother us again." After his security team disappeared, Ali told the writers that the guards were just doing their job, but he did not appreciate being told with whom he could talk. "They always got somebody watching," he said. "Who are they?" reporter Dave Kindred asked. "I would have gotten out of this a long time ago," Ali whispered. "But you saw what they did to Malcolm X. I ain't going to end up like Malcolm X." Kindred sensed that Ali feared what would happen if he left the nation. Controlled by Elijah Muhammad for more than a decade, he lived in a straitjacket, trapped by the nation's officials. He could not eat, sleep, or breathe without worrying about the wrath of the black Muslim leaders. "I can't leave the Muslims," Ali said, his voice foreboding. "They'd shoot me, too." About 4 months later, the messenger died, signaling a turning point in Ali's life. Wallace Muhammad took the helm of the nation, renouncing his father's divine claims, tempering the nation's racial rhetoric, and embracing Orthodox Islam. In 1976, the sect's new imam renamed Mosque No. 7 in honor of Malcolm X, acknowledging that Malcolm had told the truth about his father's paternity scandals. "What we should see in Malcolm," he declared, "is a turn for the Nation of Islam from fear and isolation to openness, courage." Freed from Elijah Muhammad's influence, Ali embraced a more universal attitude about race and Islam. "I don't hate whites," he announced after Elijah's death. "That was history, but it's coming to an end. We're in a new phase, a resurrection." Deep down, he believed that the devil is in the mind and heart, not the skin. "We Muslims hate injustice and evil, but we don't have time to hate people." "I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly," James Baldwin suggested, "is because they sense, once their hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with the pain." When Malcolm died, Ali hid the pain behind a mask of contempt, heartlessly asserting that the fallen minister got what he deserved. Ali lived to regret those words. For years, he suffered under the burden of guilt, knowing that he had hurt Malcolm, his friend, his brother. But time softened him. Gradually, he became more humane and more forgiving. "I wish I'd been able to tell Malcolm I was sorry, that he was right about so many things," Ali said,
more than 40 years after Malcolm died. Malcolm X was a great thinker and an even greater friend, he reflected. I might never have become a Muslim if it hadn't been for Malcolm. If I could go back and do it over again, I would never have turned my back on him. It was the wisdom of decades speaking, years spent fighting in the ring and evolving outside it. By the time he retired from boxing, he was nearly 40 years old, his body and face ravaged by ring wars with Joe Frazier, George Foreman, and Ken Norton. By then, he'd become an American icon, more than fulfilling his youthful assertions that he was the greatest. As an athlete and man, he was in a class of his own, and it is unlikely that any sportsman will ever duplicate his worldwide fame and importance. But after all the matches won and lost, all the honors received and forgotten, how many times must he have returned to those days in the early years of his career, when his body was as lithe as a dancer's and his face unmarked in its innocence, remembering the wise man who spoke with such confidence and passion, telling him about Allah's plan for his life. For about 2 years, Malcolm X counseled and spiritually guided the young boxer, instructing him on the evil ways of the world, but also, more importantly, convincing him to love himself and his people. They were like blood brothers then, Malcolm X and Cassius Clay. And briefly, it must have seemed as if the world was theirs. That it ended violently and tragically does not diminish what they once had. From the first, theirs was an improbable relationship. The brash Olympic champion who spoke in rhymes and the ex-con disinterested in sports appeared to have nothing in common, save ego and an attraction to center stage. But perhaps they sensed some deeper kindred spirit, or some void that the other filled. Cassius loved magic and needed a powerful friend and mentor. Tall, strong, articulate, Malcolm talked of dreams and Armageddon, trafficking in the supernatural and the spiritual, promising a topsy-turvy new world where the racial order would be reversed. All he asked for in return, at least at first, was faith. It appealed to the dreamer in Cassius and validated the stories and fantasies he had heard from his father. But what attracted Malcolm to Clay? In the early 1960s, the media treated the boxer as an adolescent clown, a bloviating athlete who lacked modesty, propriety, and dignity, the very traits that characterized Malcolm. Yet Malcolm knew that a wise man could play a clown. He looked behind the facade, seeing that even if Clay acted like a clown, he never behaved like a subservient one. He defined himself, asserting strength and pride, proclaiming his worth as a boxer and a black man. And most crucially, he attracted an audience whenever he spoke. If Malcolm did not immediately recognize Clay's political potential, if he did not sense right away that he could mobilize his unique celebrity, he soon grasped that fundamental reality. At a time when Malcolm's ties to Elijah Muhammad were dissolving, Cassius, with the media he commanded and the followers he attracted, was a prize to be won. In the year and a half before Cassius won the heavyweight crown, Malcolm consciously molded him into Muhammad Ali. Cassius adopted Malcolm's rhetoric, mimicked his delivery, and copied his cool, regal pose. He became, as a few journalists dimly sensed, a clone of his mentor. Always adept at imitation, Clay could slide into his Cassius X persona at a moment's notice, dispensing Malcolm's ideas and words like a seasoned actor. But after Cassius defeated Sonny Liston for the title, at the instant when his political value to Malcolm was the highest, the preacher lost his convert. Malcolm may have shaped Muhammad Ali, but Elijah Muhammad anointed Cassius as Muhammad Ali. Ali followed Elijah for a decade, but their relationship was never as intimate as the one he shared with Malcolm. Malcolm, Ali came to realize, anticipated the course of the future. And although it took him 10 years, Ali eventually followed the political and religious path that Malcolm had just begun to pioneer when he was assassinated. In time,
Ali understood that who he was and who he became were the results of his friendship with Malcolm. He knew that without Malcolm X, he never would have become Muhammad Ali. This concludes Blood Brothers by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith, narrated by David Drummond.
Context of white supremacy, again, for folks who want a hard copy book to follow along with. Sam Greenlee, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. We will start that next Friday. Looking forward. If you would like to share a final thought, final word, feel free to dial in the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. One of our readers wrote her commentary in. She said, "I would like to comment from a non-white black female perspective. Briefly, my sister was married for about a year to a black male from the Nation of Islam during the mid-90s. He is from Chicago, and they had a daughter together. Very, very unfortunate. He struck her in the face. First time, last time, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., and you, Gus, would be so proud of her as well as I, her older sister. Long story short, she went to the mosque, Mariam, a couple of times to speak to the Supreme Captain or any related body of leadership, and even wrote a letter to Minister Farrakhan seeking both help or protection, but to no avail. Now her husband's father, who is part of the elite fruit of Islam, FOI, who personally guarded the minister on social and business trips, told her to take him to court. Shocked and horrified, other than that, she received no assistance, guidance, or protection from either the FOI or the NOI. She divorced him and received full custody of their child, for which he did not want to have any relationship. Now the daughter is doing well, primarily and in her last year of college on the West Coast, but obviously she is emotionally scarred, as she confided in her mother for not having a decent father growing up. Now my thoughts on the book, which one of your, I think she's talking about karma, believed. I would like to comment on Muhammad Ali's first wife, Sanji, who is a cocktail waitress, in which he told the fruit that the only reason he married her because she agreed to submit to him. Now, the NOI speaks highly on how they highly respect and appreciate and esteem the black woman. Total hypocrisy throughout some parts of the reading. Mr. Ali, on his first visit to Egypt, as he eagerly boasted to others of having four wives, women, and what they will do for him, one woman to feed him, one to wash him, one woman to shine his shoes, and he didn't even know that what the fourth wife would do. What a disgrace, adding more to an already sick injury and insult to the black women, where Herbert scorned him. Man, you don't marry no girl like this. She's a cocktail waitress and wears one of those bunny things on her behind. So is was Herbert telling us that the black woman who've had a few questionable, suspicious transgressions, cannot be reformed. However, Mr. Malcolm X himself, who was a pimp, hustler, gambler, used drugs, and solicited black women to white men's abuses and fantasies, as he shamefully admits in his own autobiography with Alex Haley, was able to be reformed, forgiven, and even honored by many. However, poor old Sonji would be forever condemned as both a sexual tool and a cocktail waitress to many, if not all the men in the Nation of Islam. Is there a double standard here? Of course. She says, lastly, have you, or any of the callers, listeners, know if any of the young ladies that Mr. Elijah Muhammad impregnated during that period has ever received any compensation or retribution for their offspring? I can say personally that I am not aware. I would have to do some digging to see if they were compensated, if something was set up, if that, you know, was done, if anything was put in place even after he passed away to compensate them or to take care of the children. But I am not aware. If any of the callers have any information on that, feel free to answer the question. Any of the folks who dialed in with commentary, we'll start with the folks who dialed in that we have not heard from. 4683, caller at 4683, did you have commentary?
Oh, yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, man. Well, I've been following the book, and it's I really can't speak too much to the white people. But as far as the piece that you just read, and to say again, I'm coming from the South. I was born Baptist. My grandmama put us on the van every week to go to church. And you kind of hope for God, and you're looking for something into a religion. And it just really kind of show what the religion beliefs and did to black people. But I like that end part, you know, to see that Cassius Clay, or you know, Muhammad Ali, he recognized what he did, you know, and I would kind of leave me thinking like, well, you know, why he was still taking on the Muslim faith. But I don't know. It's all, and that kind of go to what you were just reading from the person that wrote the email. You know, you really can't look at black people for nothing, man. And it's like Mr. Fuller say, man, everything, you got to put it back to the white people. You know what I mean? Even these people that are writing this book, even right now to this day, I be looking for God. I'm wishing for God, and I don't even believe in no God. You know, and I study the Quran, you know, the Bible. And, it's a sad thing because, you know, we all looking for a leader, you know. And Malcolm X was a great man. I mean, I watch a lot of his stuff, listen to him on YouTube. And, you know, same with Garvey. You know, we got people coming, and we just can't grab it. That show, you know, when I see it, it's like that's what's been happening to us, you know, to where we can't really identify with each other. We can't grab hold to nothing. It's like, so it's going to take something. So it's either the white people going to have to, they're going to have to solve the problem for us, or the universe going to have to, you know, cleanse itself for us. It ain't going to come from us. You know, I don't think. You know, just looking, because that's codification. Even coming from a white person's mouth, this whole book, you've been seeing codification. I know one time you asked Mr. Fuller, say, man, if you think those people had codification back in the 60s, Malcolm X is showing extreme codification. Even Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali showing codification. The first actor that was you know, carrying around with him. He was saying the same thing, you know, man, you got to know how to deal with these people, you know. They were codified, probably not in the sense that we is today, but they was doing the same thing, and it's been like that through history. You know, it don't matter who you go through. Codification been going on. But it's like, you know, and... it's a good thing. Excuse me, man. Every time I get on here, my phone starts. I just want to say, man, I love Malcolm X, man. I know everything what he stood for. I like how his mind transgressed. I kind of make you think he shouldn't have went against the nation he shouldn't have went against Elijah like he did. Cause that came to his demise, man. But you know, sometimes when things get to you, that's like we were saying. You know, everybody got their own way of how they deal with these white people, man. And you know, just trying to be the best that you could be, and you know, bring some constructive to the world. You know, trying to do something for black people. Cause I know all say that.
Hang on 1 second. I just want to make sure we get everybody in for their commentary. If you want to stick with us, once everybody has got an opportunity to share one time, if you have additional commentary you want to finish up, we'll see if we can get your additional commentary in as well, sir. Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, did you have commentary that you wanted to share? Other folks who had a hand up, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Let us not wait till the last minute. You want to get your comments in on the epilogue or wrap-ups on Blood Brothers, feel free.
I'm Bert.
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening again. I'm Smith from New York. When we read the Malcolm X book before us on the show, it always leaves you with that sour taste in your mouth because you kind of see what could have been, you know, if everybody was on the same page. But I think with this book came at home, more so than any of the other Malcolm X books that I have read, was just how severity was and how much of the stuff had the potential to be orchestrated by the white supremacists. It's just amazing to me how they do the same thing to Derek. I think that Malcolm X, you know, I agree with the last caller. You know, I don't think that he should have went up against Elijah Muhammad. That person came into your life and you had nothing. You were in prison. He, you know, dusted you off. He cleaned you up. And if you were going to break away from him, he should have just did it, you know, without putting his business out here. If he had, you know, all those kids. Was he ever proven that he had all those kids or not, Gus? You know?
At least from the reports that I've seen, it didn't seem like he was in denial of this. It seemed from what I've heard, what I've read in various sources, he said that he was doing this, that his wife was informed about this. I haven't read or seen any information saying that this is not true, that he didn't do this or that he did not do this. If that's out there, I have not come across that.
And that's, you know, just kind of the way they do things. And what really irks me is that this book will be read by some white person, and they will think this is the true story. He let off. I think he accomplished what white people intend to do. They left you with the impression that this is all a bunch of black people who did all this stuff. They didn't say that how he was poisoned in I think Paris. Didn't talk about how much of this stuff they're getting from these FBI files. How come they're not revealing? Okay, well, you know, this came from the FBI file. These people are being watched. They're being murdered right in front of the police, and nothing's being done. And then books that have the same type of that surveillance on Martin Luther King as well.
Was that a question?
Yeah, I was just asking because I want to go and use it because I know he had to be under way more surveillance than you know, the Nation of Islam was. I'll mute my line.
Oh, absolutely. Dr. King was under massive surveillance and had been for years. I think I had stated probably months ago when we were on this, when we first started this book, that I suspect those three individuals, Muhammad Ali, Dr. King, Minister Malcolm, they probably have three of the thickest files for all of the COINTELPRO FBI activities. Those are probably three of the biggest ones I would submit. Could be an error. Other folks have commentary?
Can I be heard? Oh, go ahead, Mr. Denley.
Okay, thank you. What I wanted to say was one thing that
they fail to mention here was when Muhammad Ali was, I guess, allegedly threw his gold medal away in the Ohio River. And it's interesting how, you know, he was talking about paying alimony to his ex-wife. Then the whites who had, well, started with the Louisville sponsoring group, using him as long as they was making money, 50% of his contracts and everything, trying to control his life, then, you know, he was a good kid. You know, now the contract is up. He's able to get out of it, and Wallace Muhammad is taking over as business manager or whatever. Now, you know, we got problems with the Selective Service. And so then he can't go into the military calls his belief or whatever. They didn't want to recognize that. It had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get that overturned. When they was talking about the alimony, and like Muhammad Ali used the fact that he had to pay alimony to bargain, you know, with the government on why he had to get his boxing license back and all that. You know, all this just sounds, you know, really, I don't know, it's unbelievable, but we know in a system of white supremacy, these whites can do whatever they want to do. They could actually send him to jail. His case went all the way to Supreme Court, and it was appealed. He didn't have to go to jail, but that's probably a rare case. And his gold medal supposedly was found later on, and the people who found it got couple of hundred thousand dollars. You know, it's funny that they did a sweep of the Ohio River every year for over 20 years, and then they found this thing. You know, it's kind of amazing, but I'll mute my line. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes. Wow, this book is interesting. I wanted to first speak about what the sister brought up in regards to the treatment of black women in the Nation of Islam. And one thing I can say I have a lot of respect for Elijah Muhammad in doing was just in creating his own religion with the idea of trying to give black people some semblance of self-determination. And that's something that I definitely respect him for. The one thing that I think is really something that could have been, in hindsight, could have been done a little bit better, is just that in the creation of this religion, as much as the Nation of Islam touted itself as an organization that was removing itself as best it can from the system of white supremacy and isolating black people, self-segregation, I should call it, to deal with themselves, live amongst themselves, and do for themselves. I think that the one thing that he did not take in his, or the one thing he took from white supremacy when he created this religion is the abuse of women. I think if he had, I don't know if he did, but if he had much more insight, and I'm assuming he didn't, just simply based on the fact that his version, the Islam of his creation was so different from the Orthodox version of Islam. But if he studied that tradition, he would have realized that, first of all, Arabs were then and still are enslaving black people to this very day. Their slave trade has never ended. Also, the fact that their system is, their religious system is a system of pseudo-white supremacy, like Dr. John Henry Clark used to call it. And ultimately, the same abuses and disrespect that was meted out to women in Christianity as far as their treatment and their lack of visibility and the fact that they were much less significant, which was written into the code of that religion, is the same situation that happened with Islam. And that would have been, to me, one of the biggest signs of him breaking away from white supremacy in that sense, had he treated women with much more respect rather than just talking about it and it actually being rhetoric.
That's something I wanted to just chime in on. Then I thought that the black male who brought up earlier, the similarities or his thoughts that the bombing in the Birmingham church was very similar to the bombing of Minister Malcolm's home, and the fact that his four daughters at that time could have been killed. I just find that to be a very, very brilliant connection, because I didn't think about it, but when he said it, like a light bulb really went off. And, you know, you always talk about this. I think Mr. John Patash has talked about this, that white people don't do anything for no reason. There's always something behind what they do, and they're always dealing with numbers and things like that. So I just find it very telling that he made that connection, and I thought that was really brilliant. The main thing that I take away from this book is, number one, white people are racist white supremacists. They are quintessential liars. And I think the main thesis of what I've walked away from this book from in reading it is the importance of black people telling our own stories, the importance of us not allowing our enemies to continue to write about the greatest of our people in such disparaging terms, without us taking up the helm ourselves to correct the stories of our own people, so that we're telling our own stories and we're telling it in the most holistic way possible. I think that this book should serve as notice too. Like you said, you say it quite regularly, Gus, that one of the best things we can do is write, you know, just even if you're just writing a blog, if you're just, you know, just writing about your life experiences, this is something that we should really take seriously, because it can have a transformative process on the black psyche and also bring truth and understanding to our people. I think that that is one of the most important things that we can do, simply because it's books like this that facilitate the belief amongst not just white people, but our own people, that, you know, Malcolm X was some horrible human being, and he was some racist, and he just hated white people, and all of the other nonsense that they say about him that's untrue. And I just think that that's the best way we can work to correct those sorts of things, and also have a lasting legacy where subsequent generations can go and read what we wrote about our own people. And when they juxtapose it to the way these white terrorists wrote this book, it will give a great understanding as to why that's something that we should really strive to do. Excellence in the telling of our own story, and always actually, I think what they did at the gravesite when they were burying him, when they told the white people to shoo off, we're gonna bury our own. That is the mentality we have to take when the stories about our greatest ancestors are being told. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Other folks have commentary. Anybody that we missed have commentary they want to get in? Grands, we should have a few minutes before the program concludes if anybody has a final comment they want to get in before we wrap things up. Some of the things that stood out, let's see. The portion from the epilogue where Sugar Ray Robinson is talking to Muhammad Ali, and they're having their conversation. Muhammad Ali's, I guess, not resting well and appears to be upset, bothered by something, and he gets the sense, Sugar Ray Robinson gets the sense that Ali is afraid. Afraid of what? Of the Muslims. I'm reading. Afraid of what? Of the Muslims, if you don't do what they told you, ? Ali would not answer. Robinson pressed, but the champ remained silent. When Robinson recalled the story for a writer, he said, if you ask me, he wasn't afraid of jail. He was scared of being killed by Muslims. Now, that is wild. And perhaps that could be true. Perhaps Muhammad Ali had some anxiety. As I stated, I think this was from last week, where I think Karma, maybe some others were saying that, you know, if you read this, you would, I think she was talking about the emotional response that she was getting, and how she, the Nation of Islam was being portrayed, and they would come across as thugs and gangsters, black on black crime, if you will, today. But I would contend, if you read other sources that are written by black people in the same subject matter, it's very possible you could come away with the same perception of the Nation of Islam and some of the things that they were doing at that time, some of the things that were being done by members of the Nation of Islam, black people, who may or may not have been FBI informants. But when I just reading that, again, if I am within a system of racism, white supremacy, it is just to me, it is not logical that the group, if particularly if I'm having problems with the draft, I could be inducted and them talking about shipping me around the world and extremely powerful whites who have a problem with me. It just, that does not compute logically that I would be most afraid and concerned about Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad and his followers. That just does not compute to me. That seems to fit an agenda of, we want you to think that this is Elijah Muhammad, Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan. They are most to blame for this. They are most to blame for Malcolm X being dead and all of this. It's these niggers' fault, and they're really scary, bad, gangster black people, in my opinion. And I got that theme throughout the epilogue, continuing. This is three pages later in the epilogue. George Plimpton, white journalist, thought was that Ali was afraid. He did not dare cross Elijah Muhammad. Once Plimpton visited Ali in Chicago, they drove around the South Side. And this is where they keep driving past, and Ali is so afraid he doesn't even want to drive slowly past so that he can check out the residence of Elijah Muhammad. He's just driving really, really fast, and these folks are so intimidating because he's afraid of them, and he was malleable, which is, again, this notion that comes up repeatedly that Muhammad Ali was not very intelligent, easily duped, and could just be a puppet used in some sort of ventriloquist fashion to parrot out, you know, different messages from Elijah Muhammad or whomever. Not a very smart guy, and could just be, you know, pushed this direction, that direction, whatever, and just be used by the Nation of Islam. Again, this could be true, but it just, to me, it seems very much to fit a narrative of the Nation of Islam, at least at this time. These are really scary black people, and you didn't want to cross them, and forget being afraid about being drafted, forget being afraid about COINTELPRO or boss agents or the CIA or just racist man, racist woman, even if they're not a member of any of these organizations. Forget being afraid of them, the Louisville sponsoring group and what they could do to you. Forget them. It is all about the Nation of Islam and the damage that they could do to your life. Continuing, where, because he's having a conversation, different journalist, David Kindred, when he's, I guess, again, afraid, thinking that they're being watched, where Muhammad Ali says, "I would have gotten out a long time ago." Ali whispered, "But you saw what they did to Malcolm X. I ain't going to end up like Malcolm X." That is in quotes, and they have a reference to this conversation that Ali had with David Kindred, Dave Kindred. Kindred sensed that Ali feared what would happen if he left the nation. Controlled by Elijah Muhammad for more than a decade, he lived in a straitjacket, trapped by the nation's officials. He could not eat, sleep, or breathe without worrying about the wrath of black Muslim leaders. "I can't leave the Muslims," Ali said, his voice foreboding. "They'd shoot me too." That is in quotes, "shoot me too." Which I think would strongly imply that they shot, killed Minister Malcolm. And even I thought the metaphor, because this is not in quotes, that he was in a straitjacket, trapped by nation officials. That is a pretty strong metaphor. And again, perhaps the Nation of Islam, perhaps they were able to wield a lot of influence over what Muhammad Ali did, said, during this period. They're saying before Elijah Muhammad passed in the 1970s. I just submit no one exerts greater influence, control over our lives than racist man, racist woman, racist child. And in fact, I feel like I've heard this sort of reasoning before, where individuals will try to suggest that there are other frightening, scary black toughs who are controlling and or manipulating black people to a greater degree than racist man, racist woman, racist child. And I just don't think that that is true in any environment, even if there are some scary black people doing whatever it is they're doing. And what I have found invariably is that they are allowed to do this, if not being directly ordered to do this by racist white supremacists who are propping them up or funding them or arming them or whatever is taking place, allowing them to be in this position where they can harm and or intimidate, frighten black people. Continuing. Let's see. So this is just continuing in the epilogue. The clown thing, but what attracted Malcolm to Clay in the early 1960s? The media treated the boxer as an adolescent clown, a bloviating athlete who lacked modesty, propriety, and dignity, the very traits that characterized Malcolm. Yet Malcolm knew that a wise man could play a clown. He looked behind the facade, seeing that even if Clay acted like a clown, he never behaved like a subservient one. He defined himself, asserting strength and pride, proclaiming his worth as a boxer and a black man. And most crucially, he attracted an audience whenever he spoke. If Malcolm did not immediately recognize Clay's political potential, if he did not sense right away that he could mobilize his unique celebrity, he soon grasped that fundamental reality. At a time when Malcolm's ties to Elijah Muhammad were dissolving, Cassius, with the media he commanded and the followers he attracted, was a prize to be won. I thought that was a pretty interesting metaphor. Again, to me, I think we talked about this before the presentation, as though Minister Malcolm had some sort of mastermind scheme to get the malleable, ignorant Cassius Clay, and I can just brainwash him and program him, and you know, he'll do our rhetoric, do our thing. I'll be able to control what he's gonna go out and do, and he'll be my obedient servant, ventriloquist type act thing again. And I just don't think that is the most accurate way of describing their relationship. In fact, I would submit could be an act of racism, white supremacy, even in describing it in this manner, where Muhammad Ali is thingified to some sort of prize. Puppet, I think, is the metaphor that's also employed quite a bit in describing the conflict between Minister Malcolm, Elijah Muhammad, and having Muhammad Ali as the duped or unknowing puppet in all of this. Where I thought the last two just words, there were two words within the final three paragraphs of the book, last page of the book, where they say in a year and a half between... In the year and a half before Cassius won the heavyweight crown, Malcolm consciously molded him into Muhammad Ali. Cassius adopted Malcolm's rhetoric, used the use of that word in describing what it was Malcolm X was saying. I think we talked about that earlier in the book. So adopted Malcolm's rhetoric, mimicked his delivery, and copied his cool, regal pose. He became, as a few journalists dimly sensed, a clone of his mentor. And I thought just even the use of the word clone was significant, because I think it was way, way back before in the book, before it was Cassius Clay at the time, before he fought Sonny Liston the first time to win the heavyweight championship. And there were members of the NOI in Miami at the training facility with Cassius Clay. And they were described like the movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and it was stated, and I thought this was key because in that portion, it was not in quotes, it was the author's words, that some of the members of the Nation of Islam, they were described like the pod people from the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where they just come down and take over people, and they are kind of like cloning you and taking over how you function and what have you. So to have that same type of rhetoric pop up again, where, again, and in my view, Muhammad Ali is dehumanized, thingified. He is a clone of Malcolm X in some way, shape, or form. In my view, I think that's an act of racism. I think it's this really kind of subtle way of condescension towards Cassius Clay, his mental ability to be able to understand where he's not a deep thinker. He's just imitating what he's heard Malcolm X say, or what he later hears Elijah Muhammad say. I think frequently whites will say we are just aping what they do, or aping what we've seen someone else do. It strikes me as that same sort of racist language, and just to degrade black people, that we can't think for ourselves, that someone else has to instruct or model for us how to behave or how to do something successfully. It strikes me as the very same way that whites have talked about us for a long time. And I see that same thing, that same pattern in how they describe Muhammad Ali throughout the text. I will stop there. folks did exactly what I say all the time in terms of waiting until the last minute to get a hand up. We will, the caller at 3637, 3637, did you have brief comments you wanted to get in before we conclude?
Yeah. Sorry about that. Hello, everyone. Caller from the 712. I just wanted really to know, were you going to get the authors on the cows, or did you look into that?
Oh, for sure. I wrote Randy Roberts, who is a white male. He's in the documentary I mentioned before on Jack Johnson. He's written books on Jack Johnson as well, the first black heavyweight champion 20th century. That would, I guess, be a cowbell also. I emailed him. He wrote me back. He said to send dates and information about the program. I didn't hear back from him. I wrote the other co-author as well, Johnny Smith. I didn't hear back from him. That does happen sometimes where people are agreeable and then they get more information or someone lets them know you probably should not talk to those Negroes, and then they run away never to be heard from again. So it looks like that may have happened. If I get an update, I will certainly let folks know. I definitely was hoping to get Randy Roberts specifically on the program because I was more familiar with him, even more familiar with him than I knew when we first started this book. I just didn't know that I had heard and seen him before talking about racism and this subject matter until after I started doing it. I hadn't seen a picture of him associated with the book until we got about halfway into it. So if something works out, I will certainly update and let folks know. But at least at this point, they are not communicating with Gus T.
All right. Hey, thanks.
For sure. For sure. If anyone has a last comment they need to get in, that will take 30 seconds or less, or are we satisfied?
Hey. I got a quick one, man. Now, I missed the first segment, right? But now, for these people that been talking about the quarantine and how the FBI was, did they anywhere mention what happened to Muhammad Ali and why he got sick? See, white people, they love to, and that's why I don't really, you know, you can't really too much pay attention to their books and the things that they write. But it's good. We still need to do it so we can identify. But did they talk about what happened to him or how he got that, what he had, Parkinson's or MS,
that's 30
something
seconds.
Like that?
That's 30 seconds. I did not hear them bring that up at all. I kind of wasn't surprised. I mean, it's Muhammad Ali, and he had such a long life with so many different experiences. I was not totally surprised that they didn't bring that up at all, but no, they didn't mention about that, any speculation about that or what happened. I mean, they left out a lot of things on his life because they were just focused on what happened with Muhammad Ali and him. Roz, 30 seconds.
Yes, I just wanted to say when you brought up the term malleable, because I actually thought about that. I just didn't want to talk too long. The term malleable, the way it was used there, I totally concur with what you discussed. I also think that term malleability also on a subconscious level indicates deception, because malleability, when someone is malleable, that means they can change their face depending on the circumstances. So, again, that's another act of racism practiced by the author just in using that term malleable. Thank you.
I agree. Was that Mr. Demery for? Were you? Do you have something quick you were going to get in as well?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yes. Well, just one last thing. I know that during the book, they emphasized how important it was that Cassius Clay or people accepted Muhammad Ali as his name. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, in his last days, that he sold his name and likeness for $50 million. And, you know, I guess money talks, but that's it. I'll mute my line.
For sure, for sure. There are quite a few other books written on Muhammad Ali, obviously. I think he and his daughter worked on a project together. There are several other biographies that have been written about him. Some are significantly lengthier. That cover a much larger period of time and give a lot more detail about different incidents in his life. So you can kind of check some of those out if you are so interested. Unfortunately, whites have written a lot of these books. And just I can give a parting shout out to Bill Roden, Jamal Murphy, Walter Beach. They were on the audio clip at the very beginning. And I think they really emphasized something I've been thinking about the entire time. When these whites come in and write these books with whatever agenda that they have for writing these books and becoming the expert, the custodial guardian of black people that have worked to fight against racism, white supremacy, they become the go-to folks to talk to interview, or to be expected to expound on this subject matter. I just think that's a major way that the system of white supremacy operates, that we should be trying to neutralize as much as possible, both by reading and writing, so that we can be more knowledgeable about these events, these people, these histories, as well as doing some writing so that there are black sources that can be referenced and or black sources that refute, call out the racist acts that some of these white authors are engaged in. But I thought those were great points, and they were talking about this exact subject matter in whites like these authors coming out to say all of these nice and cool things now. And even a lot of this, in my opinion, was not very nice, and just saying that Muhammad Ali was some sort of deceptive clown, basically, just mimicking and aping Malcolm X or Elijah Muhammad, whomever it happened to be at that time. But that sort of thing should be watched for, because there's a lot of that, probably lots more to come as the system of white supremacy continues. But that will wrap up Blood Brothers. If you have additional comments or what have you, can feel free to drop those, email them in, and we can add them as we go. We will be picking up Sam Greenlee, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, next Friday. We will be starting that. I'm trying to slip in at least one piece of fiction per year. We've done a few pieces of fiction over the years. I think this is an important one. It just kind of came to my attention that a lot of black people, even some Cows listeners, have not read this book, and some folks have even not seen the film. And I think it's pretty important. Mr. Greenlee passed away in 2014. So I thought this would be grand. We'd be able to do many things at once, get our piece of fiction in, and make sure that we recognize the passing of a literary great, Sam Greenlee. So that'll be next Friday, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. If you are struggling to get your hands on a copy, hard copy of the book, if you want to follow along, let me know. Might be able to help out. Shouldn't be too difficult. I know here in Washington State, this book is in the public library. I don't know if that means anything, but it's not very difficult to find here in Washington State, the book, at least. So if you cannot track it down, let me know, but it shouldn't be too difficult. But that'll be next Friday. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what has gone down over the last 7 days. Thanks, everyone, for chiming in, participating. Hope it has been a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I will again... Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. One of the worst combinations in the known universe, whites, alcohol. If you're going to be in a vehicle, regardless whether you're a driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence of anything, any narcotics, any intoxicants, and have that be the day that you bump into Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any other race soldiers, badge or no. It can be a life-ending, life-altering experience, and I mean fast. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. a victim.
Hey, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.